We'll start off by introducing ourselves. We do have two new RAC members joining us tonight. We've got Commissioner Brad Horrocks right here. Appreciate him joining us. And then Richie Anderson. Raise your hand, Richie. We'll introduce ourselves, but as you go through, let's we do want to welcome those two new ones today. And let's start on the end down there, Dan.
Yeah, good evening.
Represents Sportsman.
Richie Anderson, Cattleman.
Andrea Merrill, non-consumptive.
Boyd Blackwell, Division of Wildlife.
Randy Dorth, Chairman and Sportsman.
Joe Batty, Agriculture.
Brad Horrocks, Unit County Commission.
Brett Prevedell, Public at Large.
David Gordon, BLM.
All right, thank you. Any discussion on the agenda?
No.
We'll call for a vote to approve the agenda. Anyone?
Make that motion that we approve the agenda.
Okay, Brett Prevedell made the motion to approve the agenda. Do I have a second?
I'll second it.
Okay, appreciate that. How about the minutes? Is any discussion, changes, modifications to the minutes? Can I hear a motion to approve them?
I motion that we go ahead and approve the minutes from the last meeting.
Okay, that was made by David Gordon. Do I have a second?
Yeah, I'll second that.
Dan Abeda? Thank you. Let's hear from our Wildlife Board meeting. I do have a couple things that was back in June. It was actually done on June 1st. There's some sandhill crane discussion. I think it would be a good topic that this RAC would like to know about. But that was discussed in pretty good detail at that meeting. Blair Stringham committed to address the season issue with the Federal Migratory Flyway Committee in August. So I appreciate his efforts there. He's trying to help us. He really is. Let's see. There was a the falconry rule amendments was one that we discussed here in pretty good detail too, and that one. Let's see. Motion to approve division proposal minus the list of 54 species plus the five items that the division proposed, and that would actually pass 4-1. So They took the falconry amendment, had five items that they added that was brought up at our RAC and other RAC meetings, and that one did pass 4-1. They thanked John Baer, the chairman. He was from the northern region, and Dr. Mike King from the southeast region. They both served their 6 years on the board, and they thanked them for their time and effort there. The new board members were from the southeast region, Kevin Albrecht, and from Carl Hurst. And I'm not sure exactly which region Carl come from. I haven't met him yet, but he's from, could be chosen from any region. But we did have to have one from the southeast region, and that's going to be Kevin going forward. He was a member of the RAC of the southeast region. So that's my update there. And we'll turn the time over to Boyd Blackwell, our regional supervisor.
Good evening. I've got some information here. Our new director was our intern director. So our new director is Mike Folks. Mike has been with the division, came up through the division, and started, I believe, as a CO down in the southern region, and then came up into Salt Lake and has been in the Salt Lake office in several different capacities. He was our deputy director, and then he moved into an interim director, and just recently, last week, he became the permanent director. So there's some movement going on in that Salt Lake office, and which one of you guys is going to be the Assistant Director Clint. Oh, okay. All right.
I didn't want to announce it.
Okay. Well, great.
You got my vote, Clint.
Other information, we have a RAC training this month on August 30th. It's a Wednesday. And that's a really good thing to attend. It's at
Shills.
Yeah, Shills. And there's so many of those stores now, it's hard to keep them all figured out. But at Shills, we have this every year about this time, and it's a good training, and I highly recommend if you have the time to come on down and learn about some of the things. I think you should have received a personal invitation from Stacy. We announced already that we have a new RAC member in Richie Anderson. And he is replacing Mitch, and he's representing agriculture in the area. So you guys wearing brown, make sure you come up and introduce yourself to him and welcome him to the area. Or, well, he's from the area, but welcome to working with the division and invite him out on some of your projects out there so he gets to know what you're doing. And let's see, a wildlife section. In our wildlife section, over the last little while since we've met, our folks have been out surveying bison and taking biopsy pieces of skin from these bison, and they're trying to find out movements and see where they're going and where they're not going, those kinds of things, trying to get some idea of our bison herds out on the book cliffs. Another thing of great interest, and we're really putting some emphasis in right now, is migration. And we're starting a new migration study, and our region will be a big participant in that. And we're mostly looking out on the book cliffs. I hope that's okay, Randall, Derek? Okay, all right, very good. And so I think it's going to give us a lot of good information. We're going to have a lot of different species with collars on them. We're going to get them from wildlife and be able to present just what they're doing out there, where they're going. Our habitat section, of course, are still working hard on habitat improvement projects. Our law enforcement, always working hard. They're gearing up for coming hunts, and they've pretty much closed out the past year's infractions, but there's always some of those that are lingering. We have an opening. Well, we kind of have two openings, but we have one opening that we've had an officer that left us, Shane. I can't remember if we talked about him the last time. And then we've got Larry, who is he's a member of the armed forces, and he's been called up to active duty, and so he's going to be away for quite some time, and we're right now looking at replacing those. Our aquatic section, they're treating Horseshoe Lake and Reeder and Lynn Creek area for the remainder of this month. They'll be really busy doing that. They've also been collecting data out on Red Fleet. Our outreach has had several events since we've been together, and they're making plans for some more viewing events for the coming months. And Anya here is getting ready to have a little one. And so oh, good. we have a doctor here in the house. So we just don't have a sterile room for you to go to. So. But she's going to have a little one, and we're excited, and we're going to be missing her for a while here shortly, and we'll miss her professionalism and the things that she does for us here. I think that that's all of the changes that we have that I could present right now. But that's what's been going on over the last couple of months there, Chairman.
Thank you.
Oh, this is, stand up. This is Valerie Fiorelli. And you know, you should feel really good because I couldn't remember anybody's name the last time I introduced them. So you're doing really well. But this is Valerie. She's our new she works with Tanya, so we won't totally miss Tanya, but we will in a way miss Tanya. And so, but Valerie, I was really excited when we went through the process to get her here. She's been a school teacher. She's worked with a lot of different people. She's worked with a lot of wildlife species through her throughout her career. And very, very smart. So I'm really excited to have her on staff, and we're going to do well with her. So thank you.
Thank you, Boyd. I do want to recognize in the audience, we do have the Wildlife Board Chair, Dr. Kirk Woodward. Appreciate you joining us here tonight. So... I think everybody understands our game plan here, kind of the way we do things. But I'll just go over it anyway. We've got comments cards for anybody that would like to give a comment. Please fill out one of these cards, get it to one of these two pretty ladies up here, and they'll make sure they get it to us. We do need you to fill out a comment card if you're going to have a comment. We'll have a presentation by the division. And after that, we'll have some questions by the RAC members, and then we'll have questions by the public. And at that time, if you would, step up to the mic and state your name, and then go ahead and ask your questions. And then we'll have comments by the RAC, and then we'll have an opportunity for comments by the public. Same thing, if you come up, step up to the mic and state your name and provide your comment. And then we'll do a discussion by the RAC, and then... We'll call for a vote on each of the action items tonight. First thing up is Hunter's Education Rule Amendments. So we'll turn the time over to Gary Cook.
Thank you. Is that on? Okay. In technology. Anyway. Well, I have a few items to present to you for proposed amendments to the Hunter Education Rule. This past legislative session, we had a bill that went through House Bill 67. This bill did a couple of different things. First of all, it clarified the existing education requirements. So in that new language right here, it prohibits an individual from acquiring or possessing a hunting license or permit or a fur harvester license without successfully completing an approved education course. Additionally, the bill, and it really was the focus of the bill, was to give the Wildlife Board the flexibility to establish some criteria and standards for what an approved education course is, as well as establishing the procedures of how we verify that an individual has successfully completed a course. The problem that we have been faced with in the past, individuals used to be allowed to enter their own education numbers into the system. A lot of times folks just didn't remember that number right, maybe transposed numbers. Looking at a license, maybe put a license number in that field rather than an education number, led to a lot of inaccuracies and problems with our system to allow that. It also made it possible if people didn't know their number, just say, well, I'm not sure, let's put in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, whatever, and hey, look, the system accepted that one, and here we go, to go ahead and try to purchase a license or permit. So the amendments that we have, first of all, for that verification of a course completion, the time that a person is applying for a license or permit, there's basically three options for them. They either already exist within our database. They have that hunter education number in the database. Our new students that go through hunter education now, it's linked right to our system. When they complete that course and we validate that registration certificate, it automatically enters them into our system. So majority of our database is pretty good. We've got a pretty good records in there, but we're not perfect. If the individual is not in the system, then they have to provide that proof or a certificate of completion from a hunter education course, whether it's our state or another state, to the division to be able to verify that and put it into the database, into our system. The other option, if they don't have that, that certificate of completion at the time that they're applying, and there is an option there to certify via sworn statement. So they can self-certify that, yes, I have taken an approved course, but I just don't have that certificate of completion with me right now, know that number. If they choose that option, then the division, we can go back and research an individual's education records to verify that, that they have completed an approved course. If we can't verify that either through our records, in the database, sometimes it's just a matter of fixing some of those errors that I talked about earlier. Sometimes we have to go back to some of our hard copy records, or sometimes we have, this is another, a non-resident, so we've got to check with another state and verify that they've completed that course in another state. But if we can't make that verification happen for an individual, then they'll be notified they have to retake or go through and take an approved course before they can get that license or permit. So additional amendments in the administrative rule. We've made several modifications to the definition of terms in there. It includes those standards and criteria of an approved course. It aligns a lot of the rule there just with our updated program procedures, how we're handling things and operating things now. And also addresses that addition of the Fur Harvester Education Program requirements. That was a specific request with the bill. Previously, Fur Harvester Education only existed really in statute, the instructions there. We treated it much as we do the Hunter Education Program. We now have very specific items, and differences with that Fur Harvester Education Program in the administrative rule. So with those proposed amendments, this will help us to ensure that we have safety in the field from our hunters, but at the same time balancing the customer service that our hunters need and expect as they're applying for and trying to obtain a license or permit. The new process, this will successfully address those problems that I discussed about being able to enter their own number. It's important to note a couple of things. With these changes, the public really is not going to see a lot of difference in how they obtain a license or permit. This is the procedure that we're asking them to go through currently. The trial hunting program, new program about 3 years ago, these amendments to the Hunter Ed rule do not affect that trial hunting program. The trial hunting program continues to be an exception to that hunter education rule and to allow new hunters to get into the field with under supervision of a qualified mentor and kind of try it before they buy it and see if hunting is for them. So that's all the presentation that I have, unless there's some additional questions.
Thank you, Gary. Questions by the rec?
I have a question. So are classes still, what are the option? What are the options for hunter education classes?
Here in Utah, we have basically two different delivery options. We still have the traditional classroom instructor-led course. I mean, typically those courses are a couple times a week for 2 to 3 weeks, depending on the instructor. And we've given them a basic minimum criteria that they need to cover. Some instructors just hit that. Some will add some additional information and have a little bit longer class. The other option is an online delivery for much of the instruction, and that's paired with a field day where the students still meet with an instructor for some additional instruction, some hands-on learning exercises, and both options have a final written test as well as a live fire exercise.
Thank you.
Other questions by the rec? Comments? Any comments or questions by the public? can handle myself.
I'll ask a quick question.
Really? Yep.
Set us the good example.
I just have a question about the procedure with the trial hunter for people who are not from here. For instance, I have a buddy that comes up from Africa and hunts every couple of years. Does he have to get a hunter education number after he's tried that for 3 years, I think, is the trial hunting program?
The trial hunting program is up to 3 years of, you know, that they can participate in hunting. But, yeah, at that point, if he doesn't meet the hunter education requirements, yeah, he'd either have to take a course here or provide us with verification that he's completed one somewhere else.
No exceptions?
Not that I'm aware of, no.
Thank you. Other questions?
Are people utilizing the trial? Do you have a?
Yeah, I'll try to remember off the top of my head. You got specific questions. I may have to grab my paper. But the program has been in place for about 3 years, and I believe our numbers are right around 8,600 individuals that have taken advantage of that program. Where we're just coming up on that 3 year maximum time frame, we've had about 10%. Of the participants that have gone ahead and gone through a hunter education course. This next year is really going to tell us a lot, I believe, you know, of those, when that 3 years is up, how many of those that have gone through that trial program are now going to go on and take hunter education.
Other questions?
I guess I do have one more question. And you probably, maybe you mentioned this and I just missed it. You mentioned the fur harvester or fur bearer. Is that like its own course?
It is.
It is.
Yeah, there's a separate statute. The rule for hunter education, anybody born after December 31st, 1965, is required to take a hunter education course. The fur harvester requirement by statute is any resident born after 1984 has got to take that fur harvester education before they can get the fur bearer license.
Okay. And is that an online course?
It's set up very similar to hunter education. We have both the classroom as well as online with the field day options with the fur harvester education program as well.
All right, thanks.
Mm-hmm. Any additional questions? We'll jump to comments. Comments by the rec. I don't have any comment cards, so we won't jump that. So discussions, Brother Rack? Anybody got any problems with it, issues with it, concerns with it? If not, I'll entertain a motion.
Yeah, I'll go ahead and make that motion that we accept the division's proposal as it was presented here tonight.
It was made by Dan Albeda. Do I have a second?
I'll second it.
David Gordon had a second. All in favor? It is unanimous. Thank you, Gary.
Thank you.
Let's see. Next on our agenda is the fur bearer rule amendments. And, Darren, if I blow your name, please straighten me out, but I'm going to say Darren D. Blowis.
To that, I don't take any offense at all. Dang Dutch grandfather. All right. I guess I'm the main act tonight.
Yes, you are.
My goal here is to go through these things as concisely as possible. Obviously, if you have any questions or want to dig into any of these recommendations or proposals, I'm here to answer questions. So the first item I want to cover is our recommended amendments to our fur bearer and trapping rule, R657-11. It was you might remember that we actually took a look at this last year and made some changes. One of the changes that we made was we changed some language in the rule so that it no longer applied to non-protected wildlife species. So the rule says for protected wildlife, you have to do these things if you're in the field trapping. Some concerns have arisen from that. Primarily, we met with the new Trappers Association presidency a couple months ago, and they asked us to take a look at that. They were concerned that that their members, if they're out trapping coyotes, they kind of made this gray area. They weren't sure, do they have to comply? Do they not have to comply? They didn't want to get written a ticket because they were doing something wrong, and it was a little bit confusing. So they wanted some clarification and asked us to address that. Also, they were concerned that people might not abide by the trap check laws and things like that, and they're concerned about just the image of trapping overall in the United States and want to foster good ethics within the hobby or within the practices. And so they want to abide by best management practices and ask us to see if there was some way we could address that as well. In addition to that, our law enforcement section had some concerns, and they were starting to see people claiming to be trapping coyotes, but they were suspicious that they were actually trying to trap bobcats or some other species, and it was really difficult to make a case on that. Someone could just say, well, yeah, my traps aren't marked, I'm not checking them when I should, but I'm just trapping coyotes, so I'm good. So they wanted us to take a look at that too, and they were part of the committee that went through and reviewed this. So let me address one other thing. So immediately, one of the concerns we had is that coyotes are not protected species. Therefore, the Division of Wildlife Resources doesn't have management authority over coyotes. They actually fall under the Department of Agriculture, and raccoons, and there's a couple other species that fall under there, considered agricultural pests. And so the first question we ask ourselves is, do we have the authority or are we comfortable making regulations for trapping in the field? There's a recent study done by the Association of Fish and Wildlife Agencies, which is sort of the North American group that represents all fish and wildlife agencies across the state. And they actually do a lot of work with trapping, and they're the ones that put out the best management practices for trapping. A lot of our rules reflect their recommendations. They've found recently that a fairly high percentage of animals that get caught in traps are non-target species. And we felt like that the risk that someone setting a trap in the field might harvest or capture an animal that is protected, whether it's a deer, we've had deer caught, we've had bobcats caught, we've had, not in our purview, but domestic dogs and things like that. But for the protected wildlife species, we felt like there was enough risk to those protected species that the division does have the authority to regulate trapping, practice of trapping in the state, to try to protect those, make sure that we're managing and protecting those species that we do have authority for. So moving on into changes. The first change that we're recommending is that any trapping that takes place outside of 100 feet of a home or outbuilding or structure that humans or livestock regularly use would need to comply with the trapping rules that are set forth by the Wildlife Board. And we specifically say coyotes and raccoons in those. The intent here is that we don't want to regulate people trapping mice, we don't want to regulate people trapping raccoons around their properties and their buildings and their barns and things like that. But once people get a field, we feel like it's important that our officers be able to identify a person's equipment and be able to follow up on those and figure out who's out there and what they're up to, what they're doing. The next proposed change is that a person must possess a trap registration license. Now, currently, if you're trapping protected wildlife species, you have to have a trap registration number. and that has to be indelibly affixed to your trapping equipment so that we can tie a number to a person and figure out whose traps those are. Our enforcement guys can track that back. What we're proposing here is that we're changing that to a registration license. And if you currently have a trap registration number, we'll just go ahead and transfer that over and send the license out. So it won't cost anything. It shouldn't be a problem for people that are currently in the system. But from this point forward, if people that come into the system would buy this license, it's the same cost as the registration number fee. It's a $10 fee. And they would then get this license. Their trap number would be part of that. It's a one-time thing they have to purchase, and then that's their number for forever more after that. They don't have to buy it annually. It's just a one-time thing. And that $10 covers just the cost of, you know, administrative costs and things like that. We're also proposing that that license should be carried while in the field, just like a deer license or any other kind of license or permit that we issue. We would, if you have it on your phone, on the app that the division has, you know, you can have all your licenses there. That'll be available on the app, and so if you have it on your phone, that would qualify as well. And the final thing, and this is addressing some of the Trappers Association's concerns, is that there are certain provisions in the rule that if a person complies with, they'll not be held criminally liable if they accidentally catch a protected or non-target species. And let me just list what those would be. So there's four. First of all, they're not attempting to take an unauthorized species. So they're setting for coyotes, catch a mountain lion, or intending to catch a mountain lion. Secondly, they have their license with a valid license. Thirdly, they have all the necessary licenses and permits and tags and things that you would need to participate in the activity that they're participating in. And finally, that they're they're complying with all other wildlife code rules and guidebooks. So in a nutshell, if they're complying with our trapping rule and they accidentally catch something they didn't intend to, they won't be held criminally liable for that. And that's all I've got on that.
So, Darren, if I accidentally trap a wolf...
As long as you're...
I'm not criminally liable for it.
That's right. As long as you're not targeting wolves and you've got all the necessary permits and everything else. So, yeah.
Honest.
Honest. I had to put it down.
Just
All right. Questions by the rack.
I've got one question. How long does it take to get a trapping license number? I mean, is it over the counter?
It's something purchased online or over the counter, yeah. Yeah, it'll be in the system, and
No education requirement.
No. So, if you're trapping protected species, there's a trapping education requirement. If you're trapping non-protected species, so for example, say you're interested in killing coyotes around your lambing areas or something like that,
right.
You wouldn't have to have the trapper education to trap a non-protected species, but you would have to have the license. And we're asking you to comply with our trapping rules if you're outside of that envelope around buildings. Does that make sense?
It does. Yeah, thank you.
Yep. Brad.
On the part there says, because it has been shown that as many as 25% of animals caught in traps can be non-targeted species, where's our stats on that actually happened here?
That's a west-wide estimate from AFWA. So there are a couple different statistics. There's kind of an eastern average and a western average, and that's what they found throughout the western states is it could be as high as a quarter, so one in four.
We don't have any actual numbers, though, that we can
verify. They do have. I got that from their report. That report isn't out yet. They provided me with those stats.
And a person must possess a valid trap registration license when trapping fur bearers, coyotes, or raccoons, except within 100 feet of buildings or structures.
Right.
That doesn't work for private property owners.
Right. The way that it's written now, now 100 feet isn't necessarily a magic number. And so, in fact, the other racks have all changed that to 600 feet. But you're right. If you're trapping on private property with outside of that area, then you need to have a permit. You need to have numbers on your traps and all the rest.
Why not include private property on there? Instead of just a
talked about that, it's so hard. It'd be almost impossible to enforce. That was what we determined, that when you start saying private, well, whose private is it, and can I tell my grandson GPS, he can do it, and can I, you know, that kind of thing, and who keeps the records on that kind of thing.
Well, with raising sheep and livestock, that just doesn't work. You know, we have to have private property included in that.
What this would require you to do is get the license if you didn't already have a registry, so $10 to get that license. And then make sure your traps are marked, and that'd be the change. Now, having said that, 3 years ago that was the requirement. It only changed last year, and that's what created the confusion, and that's why we're trying to clarify things. So as recently as 2 years ago, you would have had to do this anyway. You should have had numbers on your traps because the trapping rule covered everything.
Other questions? Yep, Joe?
So previous to that three-year period, when did that begin? You had to have the trapping permit.
I'm not sure.
I want to know how long I've been, how long I was breaking the law here.
Yeah. And, you know, we're not interested in going after guys that are trying to catch coyotes around their livestock. And our officers do have some discretion in that, but
the rule is obvious.
That's the point I was going to make. We don't want to write a rule that puts someone in violation when they're trying to go out there and in good faith do those things. So we tried to walk that line and do something that was relatively easy to comply with. We felt was relatively easy to comply with.
Could I make another comment, or do we want to wait till the comment period? I don't really have a question, but I do have another comment.
Make your comment, Richie.
Okay. My concern is the same as Brad and Joe's. I think there could be a carve-out for private landowners, livestock owners. It's not hard to determine if an individual that's trapping is the owner of that property. And it's not difficult to know if they own livestock or don't own livestock on that property. I'd have a little heartburn if a producer was losing their commodity and they wanted to set traps on a Sunday, but it's outside of, and they're not going to get a license.
48 hours.
Yeah, they're not going to get a license. I mean, I wouldn't. I'd start setting up traps and save my stuff. And so I don't know that it would be difficult to carve out an exemption for private landowners because it's pretty easy to verify. It's also pretty easy to verify if they have stock there, they are indeed trying to protect to an extent.
Yep, please do. If you state your name.
I'm Cody Jones. I'm one of the local conservation officers. One thing that I wanted to make sure was clear with this discussion is, and especially speaking to the point which you're talking about, that the main reason as officers we want the number on the trap is if I go out in the field and I find a trap along a fence line, it takes me sometimes weeks to figure out who that trap belongs to if there's no kind of number on it. Who that belongs to, you know, to determine whether it's the landowner legally doing it or somebody illegally doing it. So the trap number is a way for us to know who the trap belongs to. That trap number license is different than your trapping license. You buy it one time. It you just buy a number that's assigned to you for the rest of your life. That way we know as officers who that trap belongs to without having to spend hours and days trying to nail that down. So I just wanted to make sure that was kind of clarified. So
thanks, Cody. Thank you, Cody. That was kind of the gist, and
the same rules provide, you know, does the landowners have to have them checked every 48 hours?
Yeah.
This is starting to tie into.
If it's a non-lethal set, so a leg hold, type of set, then yeah, you need to do every 48. Now for their snares, their lethal sets, then 96. And they would just need to make sure that.
I would be a little concerned for Scott Chu. I'm just making comments because this is something that landowners can't, abide by. I would encourage that we especially talk to Representative Chu about this because of his livelihood up there, and you guys adding another layer of
bureaucracy,
rules and regulations to their livelihoods. And I would really encourage us adding excluding private property.
I have a question,
Joe.
So the tag, the traps that need tagged, how small of a trap is requiring a tag?
Every trap in the field requires a tag.
A gopher trap?
Yeah, everything.
Yeah, I'm not going to vote for this.
Other questions?
Could I ask a question of the law enforcement? Would it be feasible to, I think the landowners are relatively easy to access or visit with. Would it be feasible, I guess, how encumbersome would it be to go talk to that landowner and say, hey, are these your traps out there on your property?
And in some situations, that's pretty easy. Around an agricultural field, that can be pretty easy. It can get cumbersome because so many of our properties are in trust. When I look it up on my phone, all it tells me is, Abbott Trust or whatever. And so sometimes it takes a little more legwork. I have to go to the county recorder's office and start pulling phone numbers and tax records in order to track down landowners. The longer you're in an area, it gets a little easier because you tend to get to know some of those landowners. What we're trying to do is the rule used to be that they had to mark them, and then in the last year or so, it's become vague as to whether they had to mark them or not. And that's why the law enforcement section had teamed up with the Trappers Association and was trying to address this, because we do get people in the field that are trying to beat the system. Our biggest concern isn't people around their homes or around their livestock. Our biggest problem is guys out in the field saying, well, I'm just trapping coyotes, but that set sure looks an awful lot like a bobcat set. Yeah. So,
could you require the landowner to tag those traps with something that says this is property of such and such landowner?
And that would be, I guess, a question for you guys. We're not trying to make things more difficult. We're trying to simplify things as much as we can. So.
Okay.
What is the problem with that? If we just put it in the rule book that the landowners need to engrave them or some identification be, on it there. I'd like to see some kind of compromise because I can't support that the way that is without including all private land.
And that's a discussion I think you guys in the Wildlife Board would. That's on you. You have to decide how you think you want to handle that. So
isn't that what they're asking, though, by putting your number on it?
Well, they're wanting us to come down here and buy a license.
Well, you could suggest that it's free, but that would achieve the same thing, right?
The biggest reason we've gone to the number is just so that somebody doesn't have to put their name on it, because if somebody's dog gets caught in it, the most upset person I dealt with once was a guy that had his dog caught in a trapper's trap, and they get quite emotional and worked up, some people aren't comfortable putting their name on the trap, and that's been the advantage to the number, is that the only people that know who that trap belongs to is one of our officers or our office. We don't give that information out to the public. So.
I don't know that livestock owners care if they catch somebody's dog on their private property around their livestock that shouldn't be there.
Yeah.
So.
It's we've had problems with thefts and different things from trapping as well, so it's just been kind of a way, the numbers have been a way that people don't have to put their name right on the trap. So,
well,
is the number, is the $10 tag a number thing, is that more of an issue, or is it the issue of having to check them periodically?
Both. In my opinion, you know, I'd hate to see us add another layer to the livestock operator and trying to save his livelihood, because it is private ground. I have a little problem with us trying to enforce rules or something like that on private land. That's and, you know, I think it just needs to be moved private land in there.
Protected it's, to a certain extent. But
you know, that's my opinion.
I think a lot of the focus, though, and from what I understand, is protecting the protected wildlife, the protected species that belong to the public and the state, the residents of the state, not so much the predators. I've been around where trappers will just go dump a trap on private property and trespass to try to beat the system. Ends up on an antelope's foot. They drag it off and get seen, and then they're trying to figure out who it was.
Yeah, that's our primary concern. We're not, you know, we'll pay $50 for the coyotes. If you catch coyotes, we you know, obviously the division is encouraging that kind of activity. But we are concerned about deer getting caught, antelope getting caught, bobcats, things like that. And we want to know if we walk up on a set and there's a bobcat in it, you know, whose trap that is. And that's one way to do it, is just fire that number. That's why we're asking this. But obviously, this is, you know, this is a discussion.
I guess I got a question. What are the other racks you've been to? How have they voted on this one? You talked about they kind of wanted to move it to sort of 100 foot, 600 foot?
They've all increased the distance. They've all increased the distance to 600 feet. The first three racks, wasn't a whole lot of discussion. We had wool growers there, and it was kind of a non-issue. The southeastern region rack did ask that we waive the fee. $10 fee, but you would still be required to get the license and mark your traps.
For everybody?
For private landowners. For private land.
Private landowners.
Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the nuance in what we've seen so far.
Currently, if a private landowner is trying to catch coyotes and catches protected wildlife, what's the situation there now?
One of the reasons I mentioned that we tried to put some protection from prosecution in that, because we want people that are, you know, out doing those things to have some kind of assurance that we're not going to come after them. Right now, it's a little bit of a gray area. You know, if you catch something you didn't intend and your trap's not marked and you're not checking it, you could be prosecuted for that. So the intent here was to make it crystal clear for everybody what's required. So if you're putting a trap out in the field, you know what's expected. And if you comply, then we're not gonna prosecute.
Yeah, I have a question. I would imagine there were similar concerns across the state and the other regions that we're discussing right now. Is that correct?
This particular issue, the only region that brought it up was the southeastern region.
Okay, it was the 600. Was the extension from 100 feet to 600 feet sort of a compromise for these private landowners?
Yeah, the gist nutshell was that 100 feet is not far enough, and you know, we need to have a bigger buffer. So if we're trapping around our barns or haystacks or things like that, then you'd be. And again, if you're trapping protected wildlife, you'd still need all these things within that. But if you're targeting coyotes and raccoons around in those areas or anything else that's not protected, that you'd be exempted from that.
Can I make one more comment? I guess I can see the point of the deal. And I can see that what you're trying to do on the 100 feet around the barns and whatnot, you're trying to give some leeway for some protection, but livestock's not always within 100 feet of a barn. And so, yeah, I couldn't support it the way it stands now. I think there needs to be some changes for...
Yeah, the main thing for that boundary, that buffer, was again, in the rule, we define a trap. It's a pretty, you know, it's anything that can hold an animal, and we didn't want people with literally have to mark a mouse trap if they're setting it in their house. And that would have been the case if we didn't at least try to preclude areas where people would be doing that kind of thing, or have hearts for raccoons or you know, whatever they're doing. So that's the intent. That's kind of the starting point. But we felt like the risk beyond that buffer to non-protected wildlife was significant enough. And we have concerns about people that are already trying to drive through the loophole that we wanted to tighten that up and see if we couldn't come up with a reasonable way to.
Do you have any numbers or statistics in Uinta County, how many times that has happened or how many instances?
I have some statewide stats that we got from law enforcement. It can be, I think over the last several years, it's been about 600 different incidences statewide. Of trapping violations statewide. I don't have it for, Uinta County, no.
So were those private landowner violations or just general?
General ones. And again, you know, we're not interested in you know, handcuffing someone that's trying to trap coyotes around their lambing grounds or something like that. We want to make sure that the bad actors out there don't have some loopholes that makes it difficult for us to put a case together. And right now, it's tough. It's really tough to make a case. You kind of have to, in spite of the numbers, there's a lot in there, too, that just, you know, didn't have any evidence. So.
I haven't invited the audience to have any questions. Any questions by the public? Please step up the mic. State your name.
Michael Cook. As far as checking the traps, does everybody that checks that trap have to have a license?
Yes. I'm trying to remember the specific language. I think you can authorize someone to check your traps. You have to have written authorization. So you could authorize someone to check your traps, but they need to have some evidence that, and that's just to prevent people from going out and messing with people's sets. And sometimes people that don't like trapping will go out and try to do that. So our officers need to know that it's okay for you to be out there doing that.
Yeah. How do we get our Peruvians approved to check our traps?
I think they just need a letter, just saying that this is my employee and he'll be checking my traps. Is that right, Cody?
Yeah. And especially with non-protected wildlife, we're not trying to make it harder.
Yeah. We absolutely recognize the need for people to efficiently, quickly deal with problems, and so I certainly don't want to make it harder.
Yeah, you know.
That's where the trap number comes in handy, too, is that you're identifying my Peruvian Jose or whatever is authorized to check my traps for me, and my trap number is yada, 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 and then he's off on his way. And that keeps our COs in line as to what's going on and who's doing what.
JC, did you have a question? JC, did you have a question?
I've got a comment.
Oh. You know, I think we're kind of into questions and comments. Step on up there.
JC Brewer.
I'm not tall enough. I'm a private landowner, and I'm also concerned, got the same concerns that Brad and Richie do. I don't think that the division should be dictating to us what we can catch or protect, do to protect our private property. Now, my private property runs out in one instant from my home about nearly 1,000 feet. Now, I could live with that 600 feet if that's a compromise that everybody wants to live with, but 100 feet don't even get to my corral. And when I've got prey dogs digging holes in my hayfield and my pasture, raccoons are tearing up my sheds that I want to capture. When I need to catch something, I'd like to be able to catch it a little. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
The language is, it, it's anything. So corrals, anything that you've got livestock in, anything you're regularly going and using. So it's a little bigger than just your house, but the concern about 100 feet has been a universal concern. So yeah.
So livestock in a pasture that's regularly there, it's 2 miles from the house, is covered then.
Yeah. That's. Let me read the actual way it reads, and let's see if everybody agrees that is covered.
This is building or structure.
Yeah.
So pasture wouldn't be included. Is a fence a structure?
Unless there's a corral in the
pasture. I would define a fence as a structure. Then
how are you going to enforce that?
Typically, a structure is not usually includes buildings. It doesn't generally include fencing.
I would consider a corral a structure, but I would not consider a drift fence a structure. In my mind,
typically, like shooting next to a road or shooting next to a home, it usually defines like sheds and things like that as structures.
A building or structure occupied or utilized by humans or domestic livestock.
So is everybody looking at that? I can read it. The way it reads is, the trap restrictions do not apply to trapping device set within 100 feet is what the recommended number is, but sounds like maybe want to change that. Of a building or a structure occupied or utilized by humans or domestic livestock, provided the trapping device is set to capture coyotes or raccoons, and with the landowner and lessee's or lessee's permission.
But you can't. I mean, a fence, I guess, could be considered a structure in that definition because it's containing livestock. But you're not going to set every trap 100 feet to a fence to avoid that. So I'll make one more comment, and then I'll shut up. But the I think I can definitely see room to tighten this up. I think the way it's written is about impossible for law enforcement. But I think we can do two things at the same time. I think we can tighten it up and still not give any more burden to a landowner or livestock owner.
I think we're kind of in the comment part period now. How about the other comments from the rack? Joe.
I'm really struggling with this. I had coyotes take a heifer down while she was calving, kill the calf. Of course, we trapped. It was about a mile and a half from, except for a fence or irrigation equipment, real structure. We're constantly trapping prairie dogs. And that's just another hurdle for us to try and jump over, and we're struggling as it is to maintain our property. I would really like to see some kind of an exemption for agricultural lands.
Agricultural land being grazing property or just farm property?
It's got to be both. The grazing that takes place, especially during springtime, when the animals are lambing or calving, they're at risk.
Do you want suggestions?
Or? Yeah, that's what we're here for.
I think it's got to be on grazing land, but it would have to be by the allotment owner, permit owner. I think they need to put their names on their traps. I don't have a problem putting my name on a trap. I mean, if somebody's got a problem with me trapping, they're welcome to contact me if I'm protecting my livestock. I don't know any rancher just going to have a problem putting their name on a trap. I think they need to put their name on a trap. They need to be the owner of the livestock or their permit or owner of the property. Or an agent of them, a direct agent of them that they have given written permission to take care of that. And then I think that would still help you guys tighten things up. You could pretty much keep your language. You just carve that out because you got to tighten it up to the way it is. I mean, it's not enforceable. No use having the law if it's not enforceable. You're not enforceable right now. So let's tighten it up. Let's take the burden off the others.
So, Richie, are you asking that it's that they have their names on their traps and are not required the distance requirement?
No distance requirement, but it's got to be within their allotment or permit or within their private property. But no distance requirement, no license requirement. The $10 fee is, I don't care. No, I don't think anybody's going to fall apart about a $10 fee. So the fee's not my issue so much is no license requirement, because they're, if it happens on a day they can't and they want to set out traps today, they're not going to go get that license anyway. I wouldn't. If I'm going to protect my livestock, I'm going to go get it. I'm going to go set out my traps. I'll worry about the license later. If I get caught, I'm going to fight
it. Preemptively, if you knew you're going to set traps, get a license just tomorrow. And then if you need it, you got it. You got the number, and you don't have to write your name on the trap. You just put a number on there.
But I'm not interested in killing coyotes and protected species for the sake of killing them. I'm only going to set traps if I run into a problem.
Okay. This is private property, not public lands.
And a lot of guys are that way. We don't have a lot of time to just, I mean, the sheep guys are maybe getting more preemptively set them than the cattle guys are. But I'm not going to go trap for the sake of trapping.
Right, yeah.
I'm going to specifically trap for protection. Or when there's an issue. So no, I'm not going to think ahead. If I run into an issue, I'm going to start taking care of it immediately.
Richie, I have a question. So I've got a question for Richie and possibly, I guess, maybe Brad and Joe down there. Do you guys have issues with following the rules for checking traps? The what is it, 48 hours, 96 hours, whatever it is? Do you guys have, is that a concern?
I don't have, because if I have a problem with them taking my livestock, I want to know if I'm getting a handle on that problem. So
checking it every day.
I don't have a problem with the checking rules, and that's the ethical thing to do, really. No, I do not have a problem with the time, the checking that.
I guess I would disagree with, you know, and with the thought that trying to regulate your time to get back there in 48 hours with what the livestock owners are doing. I think you're going to nail every one of them, you know, on that 48-hour deal, because their schedules are not going to work around that.
You know? When you're trying to, and I'm asking because I don't know, do you typically use a snare? Do you use a leg hold trap when you're doing that stuff?
Both.
They're both.
Okay. It is 96 for snares and...
You know,
it is 48 if you're using something that's non-lethal. But because of our concern is if you catch an animal you're not intending to, that you're able possibly to let it go.
Well, look,
Dan, my biggest struggle is the encroachment on private property owners. Just more that we have to continually battle.
So Joe, is that a yes to my question?
It's not necessarily the 48-hour check. It's just more regulations.
It is. Yeah, and I understand.
Yeah, that's my struggle.
See, and my comment to that is it's been in the rule. It's something we've had to follow for quite some time now.
But they won't tell us how long previous.
Well, it's been, I can tell you, it's been more than 25 years that there's been a trap check law. In days. You may not have read it before, but it's been in there.
It's been that long.
But again, they're not harassing you because you're
in
10.
We're not interested in that kind of activity.
I understand that you're not harassing me, but if we... And when you guys are gone, somebody else will be in my place, and they might get more harassment.
Well, I agree with you philosophically. The more, the less we can regulate, the better, I think, overall. But this is a way to try to address a problem. And how do you split the baby? How do you draw the line? And how
so let's go back to the question. We've had 600 violations. How many of them were on private property by private property owners?
I don't know that. He didn't break it down that way. We could possibly find out. Maybe, Cody, you know something more local. Maybe you've got some examples more locally.
You know, and I apologize. I've only been here in Uinta County for the last year, but I was in Millard County for the 8 years prior. And I dealt with a lot of trapping in Millard County, so I can speak to you probably more from my experience there than I can here. Majority, and this was a huge issue for me down there, but I can't think of one that dealt with private lands. It was all guys out on the West Desert from Utah County coming down, trapping primarily bobcats and coyotes. And they were weekend guys, you know, coming down. And this was a real problem for us. They wouldn't mark their traps because they knew if I knew who they were, I'd come write them a ticket for the 48-hour violation because they were only coming at most once a week. And so that's where a lot of this is stemming from, is that we've got these guys that really are bad guys. And we've really had our hands tied because this rule changed 2 years ago, and it became this gray area, and some county attorneys would charge it and some wouldn't, based on the way the wording was in the rule. So that's kind of what's driving this from the law enforcement section.
Cody, were the bad guys actually putting them on private property?
None of them I dealt with were on private property. They were all on BLM and public lands, like I said, clear out on the West Desert. But the hard thing is the way the rule's written, it didn't divide between private and public lands. You know, it just was making it difficult for us to catch the guys that really are bad guys, and that's what we're looking for. Our law enforcement officers, we're so busy, we're not looking to trip up a good guy. We really aren't. We're trying to catch the guys that are out there hurting resources. So that's why we're all here tonight, is to try to iron that out and figure out the best way to.
So you wouldn't have a problem with us excluding private land then?
As long as the rules are clear and everyone knows what the rules are, that's my biggest concern. It's really hard for us as officers when we get together and we all have different understandings of the rule. You know? Yeah. So we want a clarification so that we all can enforce it universally.
Can I ask Brad and Joe, maybe JC, would you guys have a problem putting your names on your trap? Or your ranch name on your trap?
I'll have 50 prairie dog traps out. Yeah.
And then these guys could immediately identify that trap and move on to something else.
I'm not in favor of it, Richie.
What's that?
I am not in favor of it, no.
Putting your name on them?
No.
I just think it's an infringement on private property rights, Richie.
Owners,
it's just more red tape.
I guess technically they should have your permission to be on your private property anyway, unless they're seeing a current violation that they spotted outside of your property. You know, they identified a violation they could clearly see within your property, which allowed them to
access
your property. Other than that, they should be asking your permission anyway to go in there. But outside of private property on permits or allotments, you know, I can understand your guys' point on private property. It's my private property. It's my trap. It's my deal. But if we're starting to trap outside for protection of livestock on public property.
I would agree with that, and I think on public property, they have to abide by all rules and regulations of the, you know, whatever the, you know, the public property is, 100%. And that is, I agree with that. You know, they need to abide by all the rules and regulations out there. If you're on public property, but on the private property, I just don't think that we need this.
And would that include private property out in the middle of the book cliffs that somebody just says, "Can I hunt on your property?" Yeah, okay, yeah, you can hunt. So then that person doesn't require a trap number and doesn't have to check his traps and, you know, so on and so forth on private property that's out in the sticks, that's going to be a problem.
Yeah, I guess
Because there's a lot of private property that's, you know, out in the outlying areas that we've got to watch and protect the resource on, and we need to be careful. So far, we've been able to stay ahead of the anti-trapping community, and we've been able to do that place that okay, well, we're not going to bother Utah, but you can't run traps in Colorado like you can in Utah. You can't run traps in Idaho like you can in Utah. So
Nevada, too. Boy, just passed that 24-hour. What didn't pass it, but it went through the legislature in Nevada. 24-hour check, mandatory on everything.
We need to be careful where we're going is all I'm saying.
That's one of the reasons the Trappers Association was concerned is we don't want to get more taken away because,
And I'll be quiet now. Go ahead.
That's a good point, Boyd. You've got a good point there, and it makes you think in consideration. But if it's not the, you got a good point, Boyd. It's out there, and I let Kurt run out there. We kind of know what kind of criminal he is, and drives on our ground and stuff without any regulations. It's a good point, what I'm saying. But it, I never. Same
somebody with ill intent
token is you know I
was with it and that would frame you a number that still could but they couldn't specifically
talk. I think
if it's the landowner and his direct family, how is that worded in the depredation tags? Boyd, is there something there that we could use here? Landowner and the direct family, is exempt from this. Boyd, is there something there that we could, talk about there that would work to get to a compromise? Because when you said that, I understand. Brad told me I'd go out here and do this. How do you know that I told him? Or I give him a note and he just run and throw. I understand. I see your point. But is there something there that we could compromise on that would, like they do the depredation tags, or something, some wording there that maybe we could use?
There may be some wording, yeah. We haven't had a chance to really think about that, but I think they were trying to get to that by providing 600 feet, but I understand where you're coming from as well. So
that just doesn't work. Period.
Yeah, you're seeing it. I mean, we had a lot of these same discussions in our group. How do you... We want a landowner to have all the tools necessary and all the flexibility necessary to be able to deal with problems. But again, this is our attempt at drawing a line, and this is part of the process too. So
it could be, I think they could possibly come up with something with a landowner, immediate family, or employee. But then everybody starts hiring all kinds of employees. So but immediate family member could be in there.
There's a press. There's language like that, like you said, in the depredation rule. We have to.
I have a scenario I'd like to give you. I know this is a wrong subject and crew to talk to, but unintentional trap of a protected wildlife. So it was a cougar. Trap wasn't checked, or they said they did. However, half the foot still in the trap. So what kind of a time frame that is? Led to a chain of events where a family lost their pets because that animal now couldn't sustain life without taking easy prey. Mm-hmm. And that whole series of events could have been avoided had they been just ethically checking their traps within time frame, knowing whose trap it was once it was found. Either A, to educate, because it probably wasn't intentional, or B, it is a repetitive violator that needs to have something happen. So that's my input on it.
Well, I'm still opening my mouth, but Brad, would you have a problem? So when you said that on public range, are you in favor of the rancher, the livestock owner, having to have that trapping permit and stuff when they're trapping on public
range? Yes, Richie, I feel like that they need to, that's public property. They need to abide by the rules, there. And that's my opinion. Richie, yes, it, I think they're going up there on our permits, or you know, going up there on our permits, and I feel like that's public ground. I got to abide by the public rules and regulations. But on my private property, I have a problem with more regulations. You know, and that's just my opinion, Richie. Not to want to disagree with you, but that's.
And I see what you're saying. I would more say that the livestock owner there, I would like it to be carved out on public too, if they're having a depredation problem where they can start taking care of that problem immediately. You know, if it's within their permit and on their deal. But and I guess I, with Boyd's point on the time frame of checking traps. I don't think as agriculturists, as livestock people myself, I'm not going to say that I oppose checking that trap in those time frames because it looks bad. I mean, it looks unethical for us. It's,
yeah.
It just paints a bad picture for the livestock men to say, hey, I don't want no restrictions on, because the whole purpose of that time frame on checking traps is an ethical purpose. That's the whole purpose of that time frame. And so when you talk about that time frame, if we say we don't want to abide by that time frame, I just feel like it gives us a black eye.
I'd go along with that. You know, I just, I'd go along with that. But just come in and start telling me that I've got to buy a license and a trapper's number on my private property is no different than me walking into your home and saying, okay, now you need to buy an air pollution permit to run your lawnmower.
Yeah,
insurance.
You know, and I just have a problem with the private property end of it. You know, it's there's lot owners here in town would be in violation of trying to catch raccoons in their yards here in town.
Mr. Chairman, can I ask a question to Darren?
Please do.
Darren, is it these rules can be discussed, changed, voted on annually, right?
Right. Yeah.
So as these concerns have surfaced, would it be better to table these for discussion in a more in-depth, rein it in, and focus more on the landowners, you know, and get through the year with it the way it is and see how it works for everybody before, you know, because paper's one thing, actuality's another, but...
Just so I understand, Daniel, so you're saying vote it as is and kind of see how things pan out? Are you saying let's not do this now, let's wait,
no, let's
readdress it later?
I mean, across the rest of the state, they've not seen an issue. However, I understand where everybody's coming from, and I support everybody's concerns. But, you know, to educate ourselves on it and to bring in the private landowners and the agriculture representatives, you know, make that a focus for next year's change or update. That'd be my recommendation.
I can't support it as it stands now with some little modifications I sure could.
I think I'd recommend that you recommend any changes to the board that you feel like need to be made, because four of the racks have already done that. It's going to go to the board. It's an action item. The board's going to have to make a decision one way or the other. So as far, I don't know that you necessarily have to wordsmith the language, but if we can get a clear intent of what we'd like to see, then our assistant attorney general.
We can.
Looks to me like there's a couple different issues. Of course, I'm sorry.
Oh, I was just going to remind him that we can make our motion, we can build in an amendment to what they have proposed, and that can be what we send up to the Wildlife Board.
Mm-hmm. What the Southeastern region did, and I don't know if this helps or not, but they if you were a private landowner trapping on your private property, you did not have to pay the fee for the license. But you could obtain the license for free. That's what they did.
Which license? The annual license?
The
annual trapping license.
Lifetime license.
Oh, you're talking the number, not the trapping license.
So, your private. This is just what they did. Private lands. If you're the landowner, you can get that number, that license for free. And I know that's a little different than what you guys
still get a number.
But you still have to have the number. That's their recommendation. And then the other three racks passed it, the 600 foot, and that's kind of where we're standing.
Looks to me like it, you know, through our discussion, we've got maybe distance is an issue, having the number on the trap is an issue, and even trapping on private property or not is an issue. So I don't know if we want to make just one motion or make a motion on each one of those and see where we end up. So, I mean, give that some thought, and if somebody wants to make a motion, I think now's the time to get her done.
Mr. Chairman, I'll make a motion that we go ahead and accept the rule amendments as proposed, except for the distance, and we increase that to 600 feet from a structure.
Okay. I've had a motion. I think Rory's probably got that. Any second?
Yeah, I'll second that.
Dan Abeda has a second on that. Discussion?
So if we make other amendments, we can't. This is going.
You can still make. You can actually.
You can add to that amendment.
Another motion.
Another motion afterwards. That's his motion. If you want to make. We have to vote on this one before we can make another one, but we can make another one after this as long as it doesn't.
If it doesn't pass.
That one.
If it doesn't pass, then we can add then we can make the exceptions for the $10 or whatever.
You can still make another motion for that later.
Later.
Uh-huh. Can we not?
Yeah. So if we vote on that motion and it passes, isn't it a done deal?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Then it is a done deal.
I'm sorry.
I mean, if we're going to.
You can't amend the motion.
We can amend the motion now, the $10 thing, the private property thing, we can do all that.
Yeah, if there's an amendment to that motion, it needs to happen before the vote.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yep.
I would like to make a motion to amend that. I would like to make the motion that we amend that private landowners are not required to have a trapping license. A trap number. Period.
We already have the 600.
Okay, so that wipes out the 600 feet.
No, right.
No, wait, I guess I got confused now. Private property owners are not required to have a trapper's license.
Correct.
Okay,
so that didn't wipe out the 600 foot. That just said that wiped out the having to pay the annual license fee.
That doesn't do anything with the 600 foot.
Okay, and no distance requirement. So do we need to make that a different motion?
Just so I'm clear, no, I just want to make sure I'm interpreting what you're saying. So
okay.
Private landowners on their private property would not be required to have a trap registration license, which is the number.
Correct.
It's that one-time thing.
Correct.
As long as you're on your property, you are the owner, and we could say, like we do in depredation, the owner, the landowner is next to immediate family. Kind of.
Correct.
Okay.
And also there would be no distance requirement, structure distance requirement for private property owners.
So that did what?
Does that, Joe and Brad, does that cover kind of what you want?
Yeah, I would second that amendment, I guess. Is that how we do that?
Let me ask a question to that point on this private property. So I think to Boyd's point on the black eyes and the rules that are, you know, the ethical rules that are associated with that, because we're saying private property really doesn't have any rules on their own private property. So I think, you know, we have to be careful about private property is excluded completely without any somewhat rules. So I think we have to be careful, again, to if every state around us is outlawing trapping or making it very difficult, your guys' main focus is to allow trapping. Let's make sure we don't put ourselves on a pedestal as livestock owners that we're, you know, away from all the rules. And so I like where you're going with it. I'm wanting to make sure that we don't exclude ourselves so much that we can't accomplish, that you don't have to abide by the 46-hour, and the, because I think you said you agree with that, and I agree with that. I think that that's the ethically accountable, responsible thing that we should do, because if you have Peruvians, if you have people that to check your traps, then you should be able to, if you have that size of an operation, you should be able to do that within the confines of the rule, and that way it keeps maybe some heat off your back.
I agree.
Can I make some comments to that motion, that amendment?
Please.
So my concern is you're rounding up a fistful of traps to go land on your private property, not putting a number on it, but yet you've got a forest lease where you're going to go try to target some coyotes up on the forest. You grab a fistful of non-tagged traps. You're now on public land. It to me, is a consistency issue, and it's easier just to be consistent from the word go with everything you do. Now, if I get it, if you're just a private landowner and that fence is your confinement and that's as far as you go, understandable. But then on that stand trap 4 miles away from the river, whose trap is it? How did that happen? How often does that happen? And how can we mitigate that? So those are my concerns.
And I think I could agree with Brad. I think I could go with Brad and with your comments. If they're trapping on public land, even if it is to protect their livestock, I could go with that. Get the license, get them number.
Okay, is there any other discussion on that amendment?
I just want a clarification of what is the motion.
What is the amendment?
Okay, are there really two motions or is it one motion?
There's one motion with an amendment. The motion was yours, which is to accept the division's recommendation with exclusion of the 100-foot, changing that to 600-foot. And then, Rick, correct me if I'm wrong, but your amendment was to exclude private land on it and that the private land owners did not have to purchase a trapping registration license.
And no distance.
So that takes up.
And you did away with the 600-foot. Well, actually, it's private property, so that would automatically do away with the 600-foot on private property.
Correct. If that's what Brad. Well, I think Brad already seconded it.
So. Oh, well, but I just
going to third it now.
Back to Boyd's comment, Boyd, you need to help us here, that it needs to have some wording in there that it is the landowner relative, so we're not, it's not just opening up that I can go tell Kirk to go up there and do it, direct Boyd, help us on that, with that depredation, I'd like to see it, I think we have to have some regulations there that I just can't turn anybody loose, a little bit there. I understand Boyd's comment there with, send them out there. Family members, work employees, something like that, Boyd.
Okay, so it could possibly say that that was amended, that, and I've typed in private landowners are not required. It could be private landowners and their immediate family members are not required to have a trap number, and are not held to the 600-foot distance.
On their private land.
On their private lands.
And this is for coyotes, raccoons?
It would be for unprotected species.
Unprotected species, okay. Yeah. Okay.
Would this include leases?
There is language in the lion depredation rule that specifies who's eligible to handle problems. We could probably mirror that language.
Adopt that, yeah.
Include leases.
Does include leases.
Whatever comes up. Yeah, I appreciate that.
The current rule identifies lessees as well as.
Yeah. Part of the issue is a trap number or identifying on these little small mammal type of traps. Is that the bigger issue than the bigger, or the problem that we were to be concerned about is the leg holds or snares, taking larger bobcats on up, coyotes on, people that are going to try catching coyotes, that's where we get our real problem. That's also where you're going to end up with deer stepping in the trap, getting a leg hold on the trap. Snares are where you're going to have big other animals bigger, large animals that maybe here, a lot of us here would care about being trapped and injured, being a problem. That's you know that you would need to have some way to address those. What if you simply made for the private on private property that or out for all the small mammal traps, the rodents type traps that are set for rodents or small mammal trap even that way, don't require a number at all or identification. That would solve your problem, Joe. I don't think it addresses all of them, but that would solve a lot of them. The bigger traps being numbered have a real value because you are going to, if we remove all the restrictions on private property, there's a lot of folks who are going to start trapping deer and elk and anything else that comes into their property that they don't really, some of them, not the good guys. there's a lot of folks we deal with aren't the nice guys. They are going to be trapping stuff on purpose with these traps. And the way this reads right now, they'll have no recourse or penalty for doing that. If you don't, no way to identify even who's doing it.
My understanding, right. I agree with that, except I think my understanding of the motion right now is that protected species. So if you catch a, if you snare a deer,
right,
you're liable, even if you're trapping coyotes, yeah, to protect your sheep. Yeah. Exactly.
Because it's on private property, and you can go ask that. You can say, hey, is that your trap? Where if it's out on public land and you don't have it, that trap identified, you have nowhere to go to try to identify that trap owner. But on private property, you do have some, you can go to someone to identify who owns that trap and say, hey, that happened on your private property. Is that your trap?
And if he says no,
then somebody's trapping without his permission, and that's not legal under this law.
We can't identify who it is because there's no number.
He picks bad.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's...
They'll have to help you identify who that is, yeah, because they're trapping illegally on their ground under this law.
Okay, we've got a motion and an amendment. We need to vote on that motion with that amendment. And if the amendment does not pass, we go back to the original motion. I think that's the rules. So let's I'll call for a vote. The amendment was, and correct me if I'm wrong, the amendment was that on private, well, actually, I'm going to have Boyd state it. He's got it right here, I believe.
Okay, we received the motion, the first motion, and then this motion was amended before vote for private land owners and their immediate family members are not required to have a trap number and also without a distance requirement. And I think that was everything.
Any questions on that amendment? Okay, I'll call for a vote. All in favor, raise your hand.
Of the amendment, right?
Of the motion and the amendment.
The whole thing.
Okay. I got 1, 2, 3. Opposed?
There's one more.
No, four. Oh.
Wait. What? Four.
Yeah, keep
four?
Your hands all the way.
Okay.
There's four.
1, 2, 3, 4.
So this is with the private property four. Exclusion.
Yeah.
Yes. So yes.
This is the amendment.
Okay. 4 in favor. Right. Opposed?
No.
Okay. Oh, 5.
Oh.
With the private property.
No.
Okay.
Gosh. All right. Time out. Let's start over. I think I just blew it. All right. We're going to start all over on this vote. We're voting with, and I think what we're voting on now is to approve the recommendations as is, with the exception of private property owners and their immediate family do not have to, are not required to have trap number licenses, and the 100-foot is excluded to whatever their property is.
On private land only.
Okay.
That's what we're voting on.
All right.
And the 600 feet applies to all land.
Yes.
No.
No, 600 feet no. Just from the structure.
No, it doesn't apply to the 600 foot goes away.
On
private property.
On private. So we would still extend the 100 to 600.
It's the original.
Elsewhere.
No. Gets kicked.
The 600 goes away.
So on public land, it would.
No.
Public land, there isn't.
Doesn't matter because we don't have that.
Doesn't matter.
You got to have a permit number, right?
And understand this is for non-protected species only.
Yes, non-protected species only. Okay.
Coyotes and raccoons.
And private property. Okay.
How many times are we allowed to vote?
You can go vote for it or against it, but you can't vote twice for it. Okay, so is there any questions on that amendment?
Okay, we got it now.
All right. Those in favor, raise your hand.
Okay, I'll go.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 in favor. Opposed? 1, 2, 3. That passed. All right. Darren, thank you. We're going to let you be in the hot box again.
Yeah, I'm here all night. You're here all week.
All right.
You probably need to do the rest of it, right? Or do we...
everything are we else okay? Is passed as presented.
Okay.
Right. Yeah, everything else was as presented.
All righty.
Yeah.
Moving on.
Okay.
Can't see the mouse.
Is there recommendations now?
Mr. Chairman, take a 5-minute break.
Darren, while you're coming up, we're going to take just five, okay? We're going to start at 25 after 8. We got some pregnant women in the room. You got to leave?
You ready, aren't you? You're ready to get out of here.
I need to stand up and have a break for a second.
Okay. Thanks, Dan. Thanks
on the other side.
Thanks for coming. They're all
I think it's passed in Utah right now.
Is that it?
Yeah, I'll be right. No, they're just taking Patrick.
That's good. I haven't seen this right home all that before, so it was good. It's okay. It's all good.
But I'll wait till next week.
No, you can do this one.
I dropped the ball.
No, you can do this one.
I knew better, but I forgot to get a hold of it. It's more so the after the fact.
Right? No, it's fine. You got it, right? So, you got it. As of right now, you have your new
CR
already, right?
I don't think
I've taken it. Sorry, Randy. We kind of beat that horse.
Huh?
We kind of beat that one.
But we got it, though. We got through it.
I have to take the education course.
Yes.
You guys are just lucky I didn't have to vote on that one.
If I haven't done that,
see, we got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Right? No, Dan left. 1, 2, 3, 4.
Dan's leaving now.
5, 6, 7, 8. We only got 8 now. This is could get ugly.
I doubt it.
Well, as long as there's an odd number, I don't have to vote on anything. If it's an even number, I might have to vote. No, it's a tie.
I created something more, you know, if you're going to go target stinking prairie dogs and crap like that, I mean, and raccoons, I mean, DP trap. I don't see a half the tag on a DP trap.
Right.
You know what I mean? Especially because what species of targets are you going to catch a skunk? You're going to catch a raccoon.
Right.
You know,
that's true.
That's
true.
Salmon was in the maybe that's what it is. It probably is.
And the word I've heard is several others, not so legally. We'll just take it into our own hands. And that's what it leads to, is who's going to be ethical to report an incident. We're going to go dig a hole, bury it, see nothing.
In public, in a public meeting.
Well, the CEO.
Yeah, And that's why I asked the question about, you know, does this only cover raccoons and coyotes? Because it concerned me that if, say, a landowner's son wants to run a trap line, and they, you know, and they have to have a permit, you know, that's...
Well, here's the thing. That same trap they used to trap that coyote in the foothold traps that animal right there.
That bobcat, yes, the ones so you want to pelt.
That's where I fall on the protected species, the public's wildlife, unintentionally, which it is.
Which there's, I was reading through, and there is the language about the protected species that they have to be reported within 48 hours, right?
Yeah. That's the lion, not cougar language.
And I guess if
maybe that language worked pretty good.
And so if somebody doesn't have a license, well, but okay, on protected species it said you keep the carcass. The carcass goes to DNR. So that would prevent a son from saying, oh, I'm going to run a trap line.
If you're targeting, you're right, if they do that, so I'm just trapping coyotes because I'm trying to catch something else. Kind of in the same situation we are, but it's less of a problem.
Because
at least it's on private.
Right, it narrowed the scope.
But you go up Deep Creek, and there's a bunch of dudes that drive up there, pull over in a bar ditch, and they go fence hopping, setting some traps, just because a $50 coyote, $400
well,
pelt.
Well, then it should be.
But now they're going to have to be either landowner or immediate family.
So then the landowner, if you saw that,
well,
though...
Well, they're still trespassing. What I'm getting at is they're trespassing.
And so it'd be...
Sometimes it's... There's a layer in charge. They're trespassing. They don't have a number on their
car and
all those things. And it helps our law enforcement designate the case. But we don't want to... We want to mention that. He's trying to kill cows, killing the sheep.
Yeah. And the thing is, if that individual's trespassing on... And Cody catches them... Landowner says no, he didn't have permission, then he's got a double whammy on his hands, you know. And
so, take these recommendations.
You and the southeastern are on the same page. The other ones, which is really other than the distance,
oh, a water trough.
Yeah.
Well, and a lot of it's going to be how it's worded. It's all in how, like you say, you can layer it.
But if you're going to get down to that nitty gritty, you got someone else with bigger issues you're dealing with. Because they're not going to typically, just my opinion and my experience, they're not going to come harass you about that. Now, let's take into consideration discharging a firearm. It says the same language. You have the distances for that, but yet, you know, I got to be away 300 feet away from your fence or 600 feet away from your fence to shoot my firearm on my property. But your house is a half a mile away. There's a lot of that can twist.
Yeah, that's true.
It's making sausage, for sure.
Yeah.
Oh.
So, this guy's chairman of the wildlife board. Sounds like.
Right. But I'm.
Does he live out here?
My.
He's been on the wildlife board. And now he's just been elected as chairman.
He's the head honcho.
Right. It has to be simple.
These chairs are not comfortable.
They stay in the
hot.
Mr. Chairman? Mr. Chairman?
I make a motion to approve this bobcat.
Everybody raise their head.
Yeah, I like it.
And it's delightful.
That took a long time. Sorry.
Okay, let's get this back show back on the road.
All right.
Darren, if you'll turn the time back to you, now we'll talk about the fur bear and bobcat.
Thank you. So now that we've got the rule figured out, let's talk about seasons. This is going to focus primarily on bobcats. That's the one species that we have a plan for, but this also includes other species, and we'll get to that at the end. I wanted to quickly remind everybody how we manage bobcats in the state. We do have a statewide bobcat plan, and it calls for certain harvest targets, certain criteria that we try to manage to. And so the first one of those is the number of juveniles that we see in the harvest. We want that number to be between 42% and 56%. If it's above 56%, that's okay. That just means it looks like we've got a lot of juveniles out there. It means bobcats are probably doing well. The population is producing. If it's below 42%, then that causes us some concern. And in the plan, there's three parameters. If two of these are out of whack and go in the wrong direction, we would make adjustments to season dates and permit numbers. Okay. So having said that, here are the data for percent juveniles in the harvest since 2000. So there's 17 years worth of data. The red dashed line is the target, that lower part of the window there. So at 42%. The last 4 years, we've actually been climbing. So, again, that's in a positive direction for this parameter. And we're currently within objective on juveniles in the harvest. The second management criteria is adult survival. We would like to see adult survival be between 65 and 72%. Again, higher is okay. That means we're seeing more older age class animals out there. With bobcats and trapping specifically, it tends to kind of take what's out there, although there is some selectivity on some of those shorter check times. Guys will let female cats out of their traps and things like that. But anyway, adult-wise, we want to see that be above 65%. If it's below that, then again, we would be looking at possibly making some changes to try to get that number to come back up. Here's the data on this, and the red line, again, is the lower bounds on that. You can see the last several years of data. That last data point, because of the graphics in Excel and maybe my lack of tech savvy, it looks like it's below the line. It's not. It's on the line. It is 65%. So it is within our management criteria. If it got below that, again, we'd maybe want to look at doing some changes. If it was in conjunction with another target going the wrong way. If this isn't clear, please let me know. The third management criteria are the percent of females in the harvest. We want that to be between 41 and 45%. This is the opposite of the other two. If it's lower than that, that's okay. That means that we're not taking too many females out of the population, and we should still have a good population that's stable or growing. If it's higher than that, then again, we would look at changes to our management strategies. Here is the data on this. And again, that last point is actually on the line, and I, for the life of me, can't explain why I messed with it for like an hour. But it is actually on the line. So we would, though, again, remember for this one, below 42 or 41 is good. We want to have lower numbers. So the trend is heading in a positive direction for population growth. Does that make sense to everybody? So this is just a table showing the last 3 years' worth of data, just in a table form, and then the three criteria so you can look at them all together. Currently, all of our management parameters are within the management range of those targets. Another couple of things I wanted to throw in. We made some changes to the bobcat plan over the last couple of years. And one of the things we did is we removed the cap for permits. We allow everybody to have up to six. An individual can have up to six permits. But there's no overall cap on the number of permits that can be sold. And you can see from this graph, when we made that change, the blue line are the number of permits sold, and the yellow is the number of permit buyers. We had an increase in participation and also a an increase in the number of tags that we sold, that people bought. But quickly, people seemed to figure out that it wasn't quite what it was cracked up to be. I don't know. But obviously, they learned rather quickly that, well, this, maybe I don't need to buy as many tags. I can get a couple and then go get some more later or something like that. But it is kind of tracking back towards where it was before we made those changes. Although it's worth pointing out that in the past we have had higher levels. And one of the reasons that that changes is it probably has more to do with pelt price than almost anything else. And so the blue line there, the number of hunters afield, and the yellow line is the pelt price since about 2000. And it doesn't hold true really solidly, but if you look at that, you can kind of see that as the pelt price goes up the following year, the number of tags per people afield goes up, the pelt price drops, and the number of people afield drops. And so that's where we see a lot of variation in take and that kind of thing. So our recommendations are to remain at baseline, which is because we're all our management parameters are within the bounds. So we're going to still offer up to six tags per individual person. The season dates would be November 15th through March 1st. And we're not recommending any cap on the number of permits being sold. And then here's where the other fur bearers come in. Beaver and mink seasons will be September 23rd through April 4th. And then everything else, martin badger, gray fox, kit fox, ringtail, spotted skunk, and weasel will be September 23rd through March 1st. That's it.
Thank you, Darren. Questions by the rack?
I just have one quick question. Are mink native or are they feral? Why do we have a season on mink?
Are they native?
They're native.
Are native.
You can get they were.
So the ones escape. The ones that escape, they're just a different issue.
Usually those don't make it.
Okay.
Yeah, they don't survive. From one extreme. I learned something. I should have known. Thanks, Boyd.
Other questions?
I got a question for you, Darren. On the total population or the total harvest, what did that do when we went to unlimited tags?
It kind of slowly climbed. I can look at numbers if you want, but we did see it kind of come up and then it kind of goes down. But again, I think it had more to do with those higher prices than almost anything else. We had a combination of allowing people more tags and a relatively high bird price. It's over two and a half, and prices have kind of been dipping the last years. So again, you see tape kind of goes up and down. Does that help? I can look the number up.
So with unlimited permit sales, say those trends continue going with our juvenile take, population trend, in the wrong direction. With these unlimited permit sales, what kind of a management strategy could we come up with?
What we do is there's three things that are identified in the plan. First of all, two of those have to be out and then heading in the wrong direction. The first thing we would do is cap the number of permits an individual can get, so maybe go from 6 to 4. We also shorten the season. We tend to get a little bit more take as the season goes on. When the breeding starts, you start getting males that move around, and those are really the desirable pelts, those male animals. And so by cutting back on the season, you'd see some reduction. You'd probably see some benefit to your adult component. You have more
adult survival.
The other thing that we can do, if we have them out and they're staying out and they're still in the wrong direction, is to put a cap. And what we would do is look at what the permit sales were the previous year and cut that by 20%. That would be a statewide cap. It'd be first come, first serve. Once they were gone, they were gone.
Thank you.
Other questions by the rack? Questions by the public? Well, we're to the comment period then by the rack. Comments on this one?
We can go public comments first or rack?
There is no public comments on this one, so these are just rack ones.
I got some, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Last year we went for the season increase and went to March 1st to keep some consistency. But yet our trends for our adult survival and our juvenile are headed in the wrong direction. I just don't like when we go beyond those and try to come back.
Just real quick, that's a lot to throw at you, but the one that's concerning is the adult survival. The other two are actually heading in a positive direction, but that's one we need to look at.
So can you show, will you go back, will you go to the juvenile one for me?
Yeah.
Okay. And we want to be down to the red line, right? Above the red line?
So that one's trending in a positive direction.
But is there a cap on the trend up?
There is a cap because there's a baseline, and what we did when we wrote the plan is we set these baseline up and didn't allow for us to go over it. So right now, if it keeps trending up, we'll just stay where it is, 6 per minute. So. But if
the
trend's down, that's when we make changes.
Okay.
Sorry. Me too.
Comments by the rec.
I guess I got more of a question on that graph. You want your juvenile harvest, percent of juvenile harvest to be pretty low, correct?
We want it to be high because when you're setting traps, you tend to kind of catch what's out there. And so if you're consistently catching a lot of juveniles, that means there's a lot of juveniles in the population.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
I got it. Okay.
And so it's a little bit different than a hunt where you're selecting for a specific age group. And this is almost more like, you know, running a net through the ocean.
So this is telling us that population trend is
right. Good, isn't it? So you'd want that to be good.
It's not saying you're killing too many juveniles.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay.
Juveniles, eventually, that's when your adult harvest shows up in the data.
And it's kind of trending down.
Which is headed that way, right?
Right. The adult survival is the one that's in the negative direction.
Okay, I understand.
But again, it is, plan says if it's within the window, we won't make changes until it gets out. And the feeling is that the window was set based on historic data, and it was set high enough so that, you know, if we dip below it, we have time to come back up.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
It does.
Not really. I'll be as honest as
can. No, that's good.
Is the more juveniles you take, obviously you're not going to have adults. So at what point, I mean, you're going to completely annihilate a population essentially before you meet both of those limits, right? Am I mistaken there?
Look at, this might help. So this is how the harvest breaks down. You'd expect to have more juveniles in the harvest than older age classes. And so this is from last year, but we do this every year. You can actually start to see those bars, those cohorts kind of move through. You can kind of track what's going on in your population. So we do look at this additionally just to kind of give us a feel for where things are going. But again, the plan is based on this kind of data. We looked at this data, and then we wrote the management criteria to try to catch those variations and adjust soon enough that we could take but again, you know, this is a relatively new change, and so we want to be conservative and be careful.
Other comments? Well, I'll entertain a motion on this one.
Mr. Chairman, I'd make a motion that we accept this Bobcat, whatever, Fur Bearer, whatever it was titled, recommendations as presented.
I second it.
Motion made by Brett, seconded by David. Any discussion? All in favor? One, two, three, four, five, six, seven in favor, opposed? One. Thank you. All right. Well, you're up for the Cougar recommendations and rule amendments.
All right, moving on to Mountain Lions. So these are our 2018 Cougar recommendations for the coming season. Similar to what we did with Bobcats, let me just quickly run over our management criteria so that everybody is on the same page. Now, Mountain Lions, we hunt three different ways for harvest, and then there's an additional opportunity for pursuit. So the first is a limited entry unit, and that means that we issue a certain number of permits. You have to put in a draw to draw the permit, and then when the season ends, the season ends. And if there are 10 permits and they're all 10 filled, then that's how many animals will be taken. If only 8 are filled and the season ends, that's all that gets filled off of that unit. The second hunt management system is a split unit. And this is a hybrid, so it starts out limited entry. So there's a season that only people that draw the tag can hunt. But once the season ends, if there are any remaining permits, they become a quota. So in the example with 10 permits, say you harvest 8 during the limited entry season, there's 2 remaining. Once that season's over, then you have a quota of 2. Once those 2 permits are filled, then the unit would close. If they aren't filled, then it would just run until the end of the season. Must be late. And the last is a harvest objective unit, and so that's just a straight quota. We set a number of lions that we want to have taken off of a unit, and so if you're using 10 again, that season would remain open until either the season ended, and these are long seasons, or you fill that quota. Oh, sorry. There's one other thing. So the management parameters for mountain lions are that we have 2, but they're similar to the bobcat parameters. First of all, and probably the most important, we want to see less than 40% females in the harvest. And then secondly, we want to see, and this is adults 5 years and older, we want to see at least between 15 and 20% of the harvested animals be 5 years or older age class. Now, the plan does allow us to make adjustments to those criteria, and the reasons that we might harvest more females than that or have adults in the harvest be lower than that would be to address concerns we have with prey species. So, for example, if we have a deer population that's failing to reach objective and adult survival is low, we may want to actually try to reduce that cougar population, and so we'd go beyond these parameters, and that is allowed for in the plan. The other option is for livestock depredation concerns. If we've got chronic problems, we may also want to try to actually decrease the lion population in a given area. So here are some data on what's happening with our lions over the last couple of decades. So this is since 1990. In the mid-90s, we were actually harvesting a fair number of mountain lions in the state. In 1999, we wrote a cougar management plan. And you can see that, and this is where we kind of set up these criteria. It's been tweaked a little bit since then, but it's essentially the same. You can see kind of a leveling off or more of a mellowing out of that take. And so what it's done is we've tried to maintain this population and have a healthy lion population in areas where it makes sense, but still be able to address problems with prey base or with livestock concerns. The other thing that's worth pointing out is that you can see we are increasing over the last 5 years. We feel like we have a growing lion population, which is you'd expect with the growing number of deer that we have. They tend to track their prey base, so more deer, more lions. But interestingly, most of that harvest has taken place among males. And the blue line is males. The pink line, for no particular reason, is females. And that, you can see, is kind of stable over the last 10 years or so. So looking at our harvest objectives, our plan objectives, this graphic illustrates the salmon color is the percent of females in the harvest, the blue are the percent of males, the dotted line is the target threshold, so we want to be below that line for females. And since about 2008, we've been within the parameters of the plan statewide. This is lumping everything together. Here's the second criteria, the percent of five-year-old and older animals in the harvest. It fluctuates a fair amount, but I think you could argue over the last several years we're seeing an increasing trend in older age classes showing up in the harvest. This graph takes all age classes and just gives you a trend of male harvest since about 2000. I see a bit of an increase over the last little while, so maybe a little bit of an increasing trend in males in the harvest, and that showed up in that harvest data, that first graph. This is the same thing, but for females, I think I'd say that's probably a fairly stable graph since about 2000, around 3.5-year-old animals on average. This graph is for our livestock depredation, and this is a little bit concerning. We have seen an increase in depredation over the last 3 years specifically. The green line are the number of incidences. So if someone has a lion taking livestock and they call us, that's an incident. So we track the number of those we get every year. And actually, they would call Wildlife Services in most cases. And then the orange line are the number of lions that are actually harvested by in those incidences, either by Wildlife Services or some other way. So moving on to unit-by-unit recommendations, and I thought just in the interest of time, I'll just highlight the changes. And obviously, if you've got questions about particular units and maybe why they haven't changed, then feel free to ask. So for the northern region, they're recommending an increase of 2 on the Box Elder Raft River. Maybe I should explain the table a little bit, too. So if it says considered for predator management, those are units that I talked about where we've got concerns about prey bases, and they may be trying to get after lions on those units a little bit more aggressively than they would otherwise. If it says no, then they don't have any consideration for that. You'll see on some of these there, you might see deer or BHS, which is bighorn sheep. Those are the two that we look at. And then on the far right is the harvest strategy, the kind of hunt that is. So HO is harvest objective, and then LE will be limited entry for those. So cash, they're recommending an increase of 3, and that's a quota. On Chalk Creek Camas, they're recommending an increase of 2. East Canyon, an increase of 2. Oregon South Ridge, an increase of 4. And here you see the deer and bighorn sheep show up in those. So, you know, Book Cliffs, we've got concerns about our deer population out there. They're not recommending a change, but the quota out there is 29. So that's what we're trying to do out there. And then you can see the others. Again, no recommended changes on those, but there are bighorn sheep concerns too. A South Slope Vernal Bonanza Diamond, they're recommending an increase of 2 for harvest objective. And then on the Wasatch Mountains Current Creek, an increase of 2. That's a limited entry unit. Moving on to the central region, Central Mountains Nebo West Face, an increase of 2. Central Mountains, Southwest Manti, an increase of 2. Oker Stansberry, an increase of 1. Wasatch Mountains, Salt Lake County East. This is a new hunt. This is a little bit of a tricky one. So let me show you the map. They're recommending a quota of 6. that's in this area east of Salt Lake City and Big Mill Creek, Big Cottonwood Canyon, up to Parley's Summit and Park City. There is currently an agreement with Salt Lake County that firearms are not allowed in that area. Additionally, there is a no dog requirement. So you can't use hands and you can't use a firearm. So they're going to give you 6 tags and it's going to be archery only. So it's kind of a boot hunt. This is also part of our extended archery deer season. So I think the thinking is if they're in the field, they got a deer tag and they see a lion. So yeah, you know, you can figure out how successful that's likely to be, but they do want to give it a try. So we're going to recommend that. And then the West Desert Tintic Vernon, they're recommending an increase of 3 permits. Southern Region, Beaver, increase of 1. Fillmore Pavant, an increase of 3. The Kaparowitz in the Southern Region is one of these units that is unlimited. And the reason is it's so remote and so rugged that people just don't get out there. And so, you know, there's no cap. It's a quota. You can take as many, but probably similar to this East Salt Lake one. You get 1 here and there, maybe 2. So there really isn't a danger of over-harvest, but they do have sheep out there, and they want to give people opportunity to go out and take lions if they can get out there. Mount Dutton, and they're recommending an increase of 1 permit. Pine Valley North, increase of 2. Pine Valley South, an increase of 1. They would like to change the Plateau Thousand Lakes unit from a split unit to a harvest objective unit. And then an increase on the Southwest Desert of 2, and 2 again on the Zion. Southeastern Region, another unlimited unit on that Bookcliffs Rattlesnake 9-mile unit. Central Mountains, Southeast Manti, increase of 4. 9-mile North, an increase of 3. That's all of the unit by unit stuff. This graphic illustrates how we're percentage-wise divided between the harvest objective type of management strategy or hunt strategy and limited entry. And the limited entry here includes all those split units. So we're a little bit more in the harvest objective is the orange and the green is limited entry. These are the recommended season dates. For limited entry, the split units would be limited entry from November 8th through February 25th, and then would open March 1st as harvest objective for any remaining permits and run through May 31st. What did I say? Did I get a date wrong?
March 2018 through 2018.
Oh, yes, that should be a 17. Sorry. Hey, thanks, Randall. Typo. Funny how you look at these over and over and you just don't see the easy stuff. Harvest objective, November 8th through November 3rd next year. So that's essentially year-round. There's a little bit of a window in there, and we need to get teeth and stuff in, but essentially a year-round season. And then those unlimited units we looked at are just year-round. They're just always open, and there's no quota. And then pursuit season would be November 8th through May 31st.
Thank you. I guess I got a question right off the bat. Like here in the Bookcliffs, our harvest objective I think was 29 last year. What actually was the take last year?
I think you filled them all, didn't you, Dax?
29. We got 29 last year.
Yeah.
Is that pretty true as the last couple of years? Have we got them all? Okay.
And then year before that, we filled the quota. The quota was then 20. And so the last 3-year average harvest is about 25.
Okay, thank you.
What's our deer herd done since then?
Microphone. You probably should. Yeah.
Is that okay, Darren? Yes. Oh. Dax will pull my hair.
Clint, state your name.
Yeah. Oh, I'm good.
Why do you keep looking at me, Clint?
Sound it out, Clint.
Clint Sampson. I'm the wildlife biologist. So the deer herd hasn't done as well as we hoped out in the Book Cliffs, despite all of our best efforts. It's hovered right around 50% of the overall objective for the unit. The overall objective is 1,500, and we hover right around anywhere from a little above 7,000 to a little above 8,000. Right in that.
15,000.
Yes. Sorry, what did I say?
1,500.
1,500. Oh, we'd be way off. 15,000 sounds a lot better. And like I say, we hover right around that 7,500 mark. Last year, our postseason population estimate was about 47% of the objective for the deer. So, it's not. Yes.
What's the problem with the deer herd?
Oh. You know, it's a great question. We tend to, when we classify deer in November, we tend to count anywhere from around 30 to 40 fawns per 100 does, whereas a lot of other regions or deer herds throughout the state will be considerably higher than that. And what's interesting is through the winter, we don't seem to lose as many fawns through the winter. We'll still have around 30 or so fawns in March and April. And so it's not so much a lot of winter loss. We did have several VH radio collars on adult does out in the Book Cliffs when we were doing this study about the road, the Seabridge Road getting paved. And we did find that several of the mortalities for the adult does happened during the summer months, which makes us kind of lean a little bit more towards predation. But like Boyd mentioned at the first of the meeting, the DWR is really invested in learning and establishing better data, better science behind our recommendations. And so we currently have quite a few new GPS collars scheduled to go out on a lot of deer. We plan on collaring a lot of fawns along with adult does and bucks to kind of help us answer what's wrong with our deer.
We're also working with USU on a lion-bear component. So we're curious about, you know, what are the lions doing out there? There's been some literature lately that shows in some areas bears will steal lion kills and lions may increase the amount of animals that they take. We don't know if that's what's going on. So it's going to be kind of a big thing. Book Cliffs is part of it. We're going to look probably at the manti and the cache as well, so we can kind of compare. But we're excited about trying to get something going.
I got a question.
Daniel?
On your depredation take, do you have the data to indicate whether those were juveniles or adults that were taken in that increase on your graph?
We do collect ages on that. Off the top of my head, my general impression is it tends to be younger animals. But you'd expect more younger age classes in the population in general as well. That's the graph. I could get that for you, Daniel, and tell you what age classes those are in.
One more, Mr. Chair?
Yep.
Sorry. So, original recommendation had a decrease on the northwest.
Oh, yeah.
What was the take-in change on that?
They were a little bit confused about the management parameters. So he thought the biologist thought if it was below 20 that you needed to reduce, and he was within the window. I think he was 19, so he was above 15, which is you need to kind of be in there. And I called and asked him about that, and they wouldn't have reduced if they'd realized that. So that's why it changed.
Another question by the rack. Question by the public. Okay, let's comments. I've got one comment card.
He wants to go last.
And I think we've only he would be last. JC, if you'll come up and give us your comment, please.
JC Brewer. Actually, I come here tonight prepared for an argument because I thought there'd be some houndsmen here maddering the hell out of me. But if they're not, why, I'll just leave these. Some of them with you anyway. I run cameras on the boat cliffs year-round. And I take lots of pictures. And this year was a year that my pictures are different. I see a significant increase in pictures of groupers. I don't see a significant. Can you go back to the boat cliff east, please?
Yeah.
Clinton, I have some interesting discussions over cougars anyway. His recommendation is 29 cougars again this year. Our deer herd's not increasing. We're way below objective out there. I am going to recommend that we increase that at least a few cats. Cat numbers are going up from what I can see. And our deer herd isn't going up. We need to do something. And, some people will blame it on drought and a lot of other things. But when I'm getting pictures of families of cats, adult cats, on half a dozen cameras, we've got a lot of cats out there. Thank you.
Thank you, JC.
One more comment card.
Oh. Doggone it, JC wanted to go last. All right, Mike.
My comment isn't necessarily on the numbers and stuff, but Michael Cook. We hunt cow elk up on Diamond. Between our family, there's always somebody with a tag. And we usually hunt the December hunt when it's snowing, and that's the best time to hunt. What we've ran into in the last few years is we've pulled up, stayed out of the draw in the morning, and waited till shooting light, hunting hours, and headed up the draw, only to have a lion hunter coming out of it before shooting hours. And they may or may not have turned their dogs loose, but they were up in that draw 15 minutes before shooting hours. And so where were all the elk now? They're all clear booted out of the draw. And it's becoming common practice with guiding and stuff to actually hire people to go look for tracks, sit on the track. So all night there's people up and down those draws, especially if it's snowed. And from an elk hunting standpoint, it just ruins opening weekend of the hunts. Now, I'm not recommending that they close the mountain the cougar season during those opening weekends, but I do think there needs to be some education for the lion hunters to kind of respect that people are up there trying to get elk, and they aren't getting paid to be up there. They're paying to be up there, unlike a lot of the guides. And it does increase the difficulty to kill an elk. Last year we went up, and we happened to catch the lion hunter before he got up into the draw. He was up ahead of us, but we caught him, and the only thing that saved us is he had cut a track at the bottom of the draw. We went up, went around him, and we killed elk. But the 3 or 4 years, and this isn't just a one-year thing. This is an every year. And so I just think that I'd like to see some kind of education kind of a voluntary thing for the lion hunters to respect those opening weekends at least of the cow elk hunts and stuff in those areas to, and try to keep them out of the draw. Try to keep people out of the draws, you know, just common courtesy, because it does ruin a person's hunt, you know. And so that's my comment, is I'd just like to see, and I don't know how it can be done, but it, if it doesn't, it is a serious problem, and we're not the only people that run into it. And, you know, I know if I keep running into this, I'm going to start coming and asking the lion hunting season in those areas be closed on opening weekends of the cow hunts so that people can have a chance at, you know. So that, because people do expend a lot of time and money for those hunts and want a quality hunt also. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael. We're on to discussion now of the rack. Those are both really good comments. JC's being more cats possibly in the harvest objective this year in the Book Cliffs East, and Michael's on the hunter education possibilities there. So let's take the first one. Now, what do we think about more cats in Book Cliff? More cats added to the hunter's objective.
Can I put Clint on the spot for a second?
I'd like to ask Clint or Dax on that as well.
Are you seeing symptoms like more females in the cougar harvest or anything that we're having an impact by trying to harvest more?
Everything's at JC's height.
Hey, Clint, see this little thing over here? If you just touch that just a little bit.
No, I'd break it.
Valerie showed us how to do it.
Clint Sampson, wildlife biologist. What we've seen for the female harvest as far as percent in the take, last year there was 38% of the cats harvested were females.
And our where we start seeing concern if we were managing for cougars would be 45? Or where is that?
40.
So we're really 40, not.
And
probably growing.
The age, too, is something we track, like Darren mentioned. And we last year we killed 40% of the cats were 5 years and older, and the 3 year average for that 5 years and older is a little over 30%. So I don't know if that helps.
So I mean, your perception is we're not hitting the cougars really hard, then. Is that right? Is that accurate?
That's what the numbers show us.
Go ahead, Joe.
I don't know if my mic's working. Last year, I believe we were at 38 recommended, and we cut that by 10. Did we miss the boat there a little bit? I mean, we can't probably put everything of the deer not growing. There's all these other factors, but I think it was recommended 30, brought that down. There was definitely a lot of houndsman influence in here at that time as far as telling us they're not seeing what they used to see out there as far as lions and wanting a good experience for them as well, but also trying to maintain the deer herd. So
absolutely, yeah.
So are we gun-shy a little bit because you went to 38 last year that you're like, well, maybe we don't want to recommend 35? Is that more your recommendation to Darren about the deer herd?
A lot of social science that goes into our so, yes, a lot of that is selected. And like I say, we have all this stuff, on the horizon, all of these great, you know, new technologies and new things, new ways to get information. And so just to kind of keep an even keel for a little bit to kind of help with these future studies, you know, we decided not to, shatter too many dreams out there.
At least from the lion end, the deer hunters are still disappointed.
They will probably always.
Yeah.
Before you leave, Clint.
No, go ahead.
So clearly, lions have an impact on the deer herder. We'd see hundreds a year increase.
Or there's way more lions out there than hounds.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's go that route. Okay. So on a trend, our female harvest has increased every year, right?
No.
What was it last year?
40.
And it was 38 this year? So we're right in the brink, right? So what's happening as a trend right now is we've went and harvested, I say we, they've went and harvested these lions, and they've harvested the aged males because it's a trophy hunt. That's what everybody wants out there. Now we're still harvesting age, but it's in the female age because the male age is, what's the male age trend?
I think it was over 20. Yep. Maybe Darren and Gilbert.
I can look at
those guys right there. Right.
Greater than 5 years old, we're actually up to 40% for last year. Is that right? That what
I've got? That's overall, but for the males?
Yeah, I think that one pulled it. Didn't I call it? Didn't I pull out the females out of that? Sort of
thing. Yeah, I think.
That's compared to the previous year was 26%, 28%, but over 5 years old, so there have been some, still a good mature component of that population. 20% was the over six.
There hasn't been anything really drastic to make us think that we're really putting the hurt on too bad.
So back to my questions I asked Darren. Thank you, Clint. The reason I bring that up is with Mr. Brewer's pictures. If there was a mature tom, is it not science that a mature tom's going to help rein in his area and kill off young and things of that nature? I mean, there's a hefty balance here. We can sit here and point out them as the blame for the deer herd, and is there more of an issue? We had a meeting last fall, about the deer herd. It's a summer range habitat issue. Now we're going with technology to identify and pinpoint, is it summer range or is it predator? To me, there's so many studies out there that show, and we're using this harvest data to dictate a population that we don't know what actually exists. Oh, they're coming from Colorado, they'll come off the tribe. That was the justification for the increase, and that's why the houndsmen settled. I believe the numbers where they're at is where they should be. Weather's going to dictate certain things, but those older age class males that you're harvesting, taking them out, you're also harvesting older age class females, raising young, juveniles are the main culprit in your depredation issues because they've got to go find a resource on their own now because mama just kicked them off the milk maker and they've got to go fend for themselves. So there's a lot to it to me other than just statistics and male harvest versus female harvest. There's a whole round about it, and I think the division's on with their recommendation, and you know, if there's triggers that say an increase or triggers that show a decrease, I mean, that's what's in the plan and that's what it should go by. I don't think they're off at all on their recommendation this year, statewide.
Okay, thanks, Daniel. I guess, Clint, Daniel just said something. Is there any triggers in there that say 29 is kind of the good number? Or is it more like 27, or is it more like 32?
According to the rule, we could have increased permits last year, and we could have increased permits this year as well. So.
By how many?
Now again,
JC's wanting to know how many.
Now, again, that's based on a
population issue. I mean, we're facing a bigger deal in the Buck Cliffs than anywhere else in the state. It's deer population. It's managed as a predator management unit because of our deer population.
If I could, I'll just say, you know, the 40% females in the harvest, that's for, sustaining the cougar population. Our intent was to reduce the cougar population in the Buck Cliffs. So we made what we thought was a fairly aggressive recommendation based on the parameters in the plan to try to reduce the cougar population. And we've had pretty substantial harvest. If you look at what the harvest was before, back when the Buck Cliffs was a split unit before we made it a harvest objective unit, you know, we're harvesting two or three times as many cougars per year out there as we used to. And surprisingly, the data hasn't shown. We haven't started to harvest a whole lot of females or a whole lot of juvenile animals. But it's still a fairly aggressive recommendation, you know, to kill almost 30 cougars a year in the Buck Cliffs. According to the parameters of the plan, we could increase that more and try to harvest more lions sooner and do that in conjunction with a lot of other efforts to try to help that deer population that's struggling out there. Like Clint said, you know, there's been some social pressure, some folks that weren't happy with us killing that many lions. And there's a lot of other factors at play, too, and a lot of other things we're doing. We're pretty excited about what we can maybe learn from some of these studies that we're going to take on in the Buck Cliffs. So we decided to just kind of take it easy, keep with the 29 that we had last year, which is still a fairly aggressive recommendation, but based on the criteria, there's room to go further with it, but we've decided to just kind of keep it where it is for now. But it doesn't show that we're making a big dent, that we're reducing that cougar population based on the parameters that we look at in our plan and the numbers that we've got from the harvested animals. Just wanted to clarify that, if that helps.
Yeah.
Yeah, we got a question.
I have a question. The you reached your quota of 29. How soon did you reach that quota? When was it reached? Was it reached at the beginning of the season, middle, or end?
It was towards the end of the winter. You know, it's a long season, but it was towards the end of the winter. It was almost into the spring.
What's the date on the spreadsheet?
Yeah, you maybe have it. It wasn't hit real quick, but they hit it.
It was well into bear season, wasn't it?
I think it was around March.
It was in spring.
Okay, so the season runs from November?
It runs almost year-round. There's like a week that it's not open. Okay, the first week of November, it's not open.
Okay.
So it started, you know, like the second week of November, and we filled it, hit the, you know, number 29. I think it was in March, but... you can correct me if I'm wrong.
And that's good. Just a roundabout date is good enough for me.
And along that line, how many of these quotas get filled after the seasonal change?
Sorry.
So after the snow stops, we go to dry conditions. How many of these quotas actually fill after that time frame?
Usually, you know, our best harvests are going to be the first few snowstorms of the year. Is when we harvest, it seems like those first few snowstorms of the year when folks have the most success harvesting calves. Correct me if I'm wrong, Darren.
Yeah,
that's what we've seen.
The date is actually April 26th.
April, okay.
So late.
Yeah, it was well into bear season.
Yeah.
How long have we been under objective on the deer herd out there?
Long time.
Since they made
created.
One?
Created.
So it hasn't been that. Have we had an over-aggressively objective then, or...
One of the things that we want to look at with the deer study that we're proposing right now as part of our migration initiative would be looking at body condition with ultrasound in mule deer. And through looking at body condition in the deer, you can get it, you know, the deer's body is going to tell you about their habitat. And we'll look at them in the fall and then again in the spring, or, you know, early winter and then again in spring to see how much condition they've lost over the winter. And we're working with some really good professors at BYU who've been doing this on all of our mule deer monitoring studies throughout the state. And we're looking at, through body condition, we're getting to the point where I think we're going to be able to determine on some of these units based on body condition, our carrying capacity might be different than what our objective is. And that may be the case. I think, where we're not harvesting does out there, we're at an effective carrying capacity. Now, there's things we can do to increase the carrying capacity, like water development,
habitat work, you know, we've done a lot of that in the book clips you go out there and look around. Predator control can be part of that equation as well. But there also is a point where, you know, maybe 15,000 deer in the book list isn't a realistic objective. And we're open to that, and we're open with some of these new things we're doing, we can get a better understanding of that. And if it's too high, we might need to make some adjustments.
Dax, back in the day, the 80s, what was the population in the book list? Do you know if there's data available?
You know, Clint, you remember? I know.
I was out there a lot in the 80s, and so I'm trying to decide.
He was here back then.
I was out there in the 80s, so,
yeah. 15 years, it seems like we've, in the last, you know, 15-plus years, it's been in that, you know, 7,000 to 9,000 range is where that population has been for the most part. Now, I don't know back in the 80s. We can probably look at some of the old annual reports, but I don't know.
We took a huge dip at one.
Set based on what they were killing back in 93, what they saw the population was in 90 through 93, that big winter right prior to the big die-off that we had then. Those population objectives, most of them were set for about what we had prior to that big winter.
We did take a huge dip, and it was closed for
90. It was 3 years, 96, 97, 98.
Yeah, and then it was opened back up again, so.
They tried a three-pointer better out there in 84 through about 89. Yeah, that was the start of the demise, in my opinion. But so,
thanks, Dex. All right, any other comments on the rack?
I got one question.
Please do.
So, in the plan, it doesn't outline season dates or portions of that nature, right? So we can vote, not realistically, but every year to move a season date one way or another.
Yeah, you could.
Okay. We haven't talked about the hunter's education portion of it.
That'd be something that we could easily add to our the lion education online thing that people have to take that. Right now we're focusing on telling the difference between males and females, but we could add a blurb about, you know, you're sharing the mountain with other people. Please be courteous of other users. Something like that would be easy to add.
Especially during the first opening weekend of cow season.
Yeah, let's go to that reverse perspective.
I know they want to go when it snows. I mean, they can't. I mean, that's pretty important that it.
Let's talk about spike elk hunters and Buck Cliffs bear hunters. 15 years versus an over-the-counter tag. Go try to hunt that bear with all them spike elk hunters being courteous to you and that bear tag that took you 15 years to get. I mean, it's a two-way street, inevitably. It just boils right down to that individual. I education or not, a course, they're there. And it goes both ways.
Good point, Daniel. Okay, I'm not sure where we are, but any other discussion before we call for a motion on this one? JC?
I know I spoke
up, but
I've got a question for Dax.
Yep. Step up the mic, if you would, please, as I can catch it on record.
JC Brewer. Question for Dax when he was talking about this study that they're going to do on body condition. On the deer herd, he said that he was going to do it fall and spring. I have maintained for some time that our problem in the Buck Cliffs is not winter range. It's not winter kill. Our fawns that we're losing out there are summer kill. I would like to see if he's going to do this kind of study, that they do this kind of study year-round, look at the body condition in the spring and the fall on the summer range, which is a very narrow band of a mountain out there, and we've got a large winter range. So I'm trying to get the thinking, if you will, of everyone involved in deer management out there to start thinking about how we are impacting our deer herd in the summer. We've got 3,000 head of cattle on the mountain out there. We've got 7,000 at least deer out there. Now we're introducing buffalo, and we come off that mountain. Our deer herd comes off that mountain with 40% of their fawns in the fall. Something's wrong with our summer range management folks, not our winter range. Can we get that same study that you're talking about doing on the deer conditions in the summer? See what is the matter with our deer condition in the fall when they come off of that mountain? Are we putting too many animals on the top of that mountain? Because that's what I'm maintaining.
I'll talk to that just a little bit. So, you know, when we get those body conditions in the fall, that, you know, we're capturing what they had to eat that summer, you know, when they're gaining that weight. So we know, you know, what they've gained over the summer, and then we look at them again in the spring and see what they've lost over the winter. And so I think we're trying to get some of the same things you're getting at with looking at body condition in the fall after they've been eating all summer. You know, we'll be looking at body condition early December. And so they've had pretty darn good nutrition right up until then is when stuff really starts freezing and you start losing availability of nutrition due to snow depth and stuff. So I think we're looking at that. And then we put in vaginal implant transmitters in the does. And so when they fawn, we'll go catch the fawns and put a radio collar on the fawn. And so we'll monitor fawn survival through the summer. And that'll also be a big indicator if summer nutritional shortage in the summer are playing a big factor. You know, if these fawns are starving to death because their moms aren't getting enough to eat and aren't able to produce enough milk to keep the fawns alive, or if the fawns are being eaten by predators, you know, it'll answer some of those questions once we have collared fawns or collared out calves to see, you know, why are we losing these deer? Is it a habitat issue? And that's probably part of it. But there's some of these things, we have some ideas, but it'll help us confirm some of those things, and we'll probably learn some stuff we didn't know. But, you know, those are some of the questions we want to get at with this study that we're in the works right now that we're developing. Good questions.
Thanks, Dex.
Mr. Chair?
Yep.
I got one more question. And it goes to a biologist standpoint on the cougars. So we tend to get away from the split harvest because of filling the quota. We lose those optimal times to harvest those lions. Because of the snowfall, the conditions make it easier to obtain. If that season date was to be February 1st rather than March 1st, that still leaves suitable conditions, storms to move through. Would there be possibly a bigger consideration to hold more split harvest hunts in that aspect to allow those quotas to be filled? Because, I mean, a lot of them, if they do open, it's one or two left, or say it is larger than that, and you put a bigger quota on it. I mean, management-wise, seasonally, would that be a bigger consideration?
I think it's probably more social than anything, but I do have landowners that are, you know, they're running animals on split units, and they've been concerned about, you know, by the time it opens up, they say it's too late to get, you know, the snow's gone, and the conditions aren't that good. So I've heard that argument for shortening the split season. I think that the other side of the coin is they do look at those people that are hunting on that. You know, it is a limited entry opportunity, and so you'd be shorting the opportunity that whatever that small number of people who drew a tag could be a field. So, but again, these are from a biological standpoint. It would make a difference. It depends on what's going on.
As long as the quota was filled.
Yeah, exactly.
Happy.
If the quota's getting filled, it's probably a distinction without a difference. If it's not, then, yeah, you might get some additional harvest. But you open the door and let everybody who's got dogs hit the ground. So
where I'm going with that as a comment is those folks would like to have that limited entry opportunity but still be able to allow biologically to harvest the quota. Short season or not, they're going to get to hunt the whole season because until they harvest that cougar, the permit's valid. So even once it goes to split objective, they can continue hunting once it opens up to the public. And as a houndsman and a cougar hunter, the opportunity of an enjoyable opportunity, just like the 10, 12 years put in for a big game species that everybody else goes to hunt. So
those opportunities are dwindling. In Darren's graph, those opportunities are just on their way out the window. And it those quality times where it's general season versus limited entry, it's no different for a harvest objective to a split. We still see biological sense in it, but at the same time having an opportunity.
Thank you, Daniel. Any other comments on this topic? I'll call for a motion.
I'll make a motion to accept the permits as presented. So it'll be a three-part motion. The permit numbers is recommended by the state. The season dates for the split harvest move to February 1st rather than March 1st. And to leave that split harvest unit to harvest objective as a split unit. And forgive me for the name.
Which unit are you talking about?
There's only one being recommended to change. It's the Plateau Thousand Lakes to maintain split harvest.
Instead of going to harvest objective.
Yes.
Fish and Game got their studies.
It's in the southeast region.
It's not even in our region.
Sure, but it would be the same as March 1st, right? So it would be the same verbiage.
Yeah. I just wanted to make sure you're aware that we
sure.
have to make sure we, I don't know whatever February 2nd is. But I got you. So, for harvest objective.
Just giving.
No. Just using the same verbiage as we would March 1st, but allowing more seasonal opportunity to fill the objective.
Yep.
Yes, sir.
Can you repeat leave the split harvest unit?
The Thousand Lakes, Plateau Thousand Lakes, as a split harvest.
Rather than harvest only?
Correct.
Still short enough.
Just to allow it, for a limited entry.
Opportunity with the seasonal advantage of being able to fill the harvest of what's not met.
Okay, you had three different ones. One of them was the permit numbers stay as they are.
As recommended.
The Plateau, Thousand Lakes, stay as a split instead of a harvest objective. And what was your third part of it?
Moving the split season, limited entry date, excuse me, the harvest objective date on the split season unit to open as close to February 1st as allowed by code.
Okay. From basically the 1st of March to sometime the 1st of February. First part. Okay. All right, we've got a motion on the floor. We need a second.
I ask real quick a question of any, as far as recommendations by the other RACs according to this?
Most of them, I think all of them have passed as recommended, so they haven't made any changes.
I'm not hearing a second. Okay, that motion dies. We need a motion. Mr. Horrocks.
I'd like to make a motion to accept it as, recommend that we accept it as presented.
A motion to approve it as presented. Do I have a second on that one?
I'll second. Daniel.
Daniel. All in favor? It's unanimous. Well, we're going to keep you in the hot seat one more time, Darren, for the beaver management plan.
All right.
I forgot the 100 steps.
This one ought to sell us. I want to make it.
No, you cannot.
Introduce the beavers.
All right. Last but not least, I guess. Okay, so our final recommendation is some changes and updates to our beaver management plan for the state. This plan, we actually wrote a management plan in 2010, and in that plan we call for a review every 5 years. We're a little beyond that, but we began in December of 2016 to go through that and review that plan. Just we did an internal review. We had members of the Habitat section, Aquatics and Wildlife sections on that committee. We also consulted with some experts at USU and talked to the Trappers Association as well. So here are the results. First of all, there were many goals and objectives in the plan that we accomplished, and so we updated those and made changes to those as necessary. The second part is in the original plan, one of the things we accomplished is we identified we wanted to create a computer model that helped us to do a couple of things. One would be to assess the suitability of beaver habitat across the state, and from that we can move forward into assessing how many the population looks like. We didn't really have any data at all on beaver other than take. And so the product that came out of that was developed by USU, and they named it the Beaver Reintroduction Assessment Tool, or BRAT. It's more than reintroduction, but we'll go with that. So what we've done is we've taken that model and incorporated it into the plan, and we want to use that when we make decisions about beaver management across the state. The other thing that we wanted to do is to encourage the use, where appropriate, of beavers to restore riparian habitats. So releasing beavers into areas where there's materials to build dams. And again, I'll go into that a little bit more detail and explain. First of all, what this model does, this BRAT model, it's a satellite data-based model, so it looks at certain criteria on the ground. Again, habitat suitable for dam building, so it looks at aspect, it looks at woody vegetation, it looks at stream width and things like that. And what it also does, though, is it looks at the likelihood for human conflict, and it flags areas where if you release beavers, there's a likelihood for there to be a problem with people. And it's a very conservative part of the model, so we err on the side of being cautious. So if it's close to a road, if it's on private property, if it's close to a trail, it gets flagged. That doesn't mean that we necessarily couldn't do work there, but it means we need to go in on the ground, assess the risks, work with the stakeholders, land management agencies, private landers, that kind of thing. And if we can't put something together, then we don't do it there. The model categorizes sections into different categories, and we've identified which categories we would want to work on first. And so what it does is it kind of stacks these layers on the landscape based on different satellite data. And that's how GIS, geographic information systems, work. And what it does is it helps us kind of visualize in space what's going on. It's a little easier to figure out than just looking at a table of numbers. So here's an example of how it would work. This is an output from the model. This is actually the Spawn Creek area up just east of Logan in Logan Canyon. It's actually left-hand fork in Logan Canyon. And so you can see the categories up there. Don't get too hung up on all of those. Let me just say that blue and green are more suitable. Yellow, orange, and red. Oh, thanks. I forgot I had that. Okay. Trying to be quick. Orange and red is a little less suitable. And it has to do with what's available there. We'd probably focus on these areas initially, these sort of green and blue areas, if we wanted. Now, there may already be beavers there. And so, again, we need to go in on the ground as well and just see Now, if you lay the human conflict model on top of that, see how everything turns red. In this instant, there's a trail, foot trail, that goes up along that. You can see the roads, and so the model says, essentially, it's suitable, but you might have some human conflict problems. And so, in this case, we'd want to work with the Forest Service, with the management agency, and they may want to go ahead and proceed. You know, it kicks it out because there's a trail in a straight line distance. But for example, these roads are actually up out of the floodplain, but it's close. And so you may go in and say, well, there's not really any risk of flooding here, so we might want to proceed there. Or alternatively, you know, over here is Logan Canyon and the highway. We probably don't want to encourage beaver activity in culverts and flooding the highway, that kind of thing. Okay. The other question that arises is just, why would you want to do this? Why would you want to move beavers around in the first place? There can be some considerable benefits. They do raise water tables by building dams. You can, over time, eliminate cut bank streams, so streams that have been sized into the strata. That buildup of silt behind actually raises that water level, and then it'll start to flood into the floodplain. In some instances, that's a good thing. In other instances, maybe not such a good thing, and so you'd need to make sure you're assessing that. Once that floodplain is reconnected, you do get some additional benefits to big game and livestock in terms of grazing and riparian areas. You get more diverse systems, and it actually can slow runoff in that system and give you some silt retention and flood control, which is good for fisheries. The other thing the plan specifies is that we're not just going to go move these animals around without considering aquatic invasive species. That's what AIS stands for. So whirling disease, quagga, mussels, things like that. If beavers are living in waters that have those invasive species in them, we've said that, and this is in large part due to our fisheries folks weighing in, they're okay with us moving into other waters that already have those problems. So we're not moving stuff around. We're just moving dirty to dirty, I guess. The second situation would be beavers in areas without those kind of problems. They could be moved anywhere into dirty, dirty water or into clean. And the final would be where, if we're not quite sure what the status is, we require a 72-hour quarantine. And we have a protocol. This allows the beavers to eliminate stuff out of their system. We change the water. We spray them down. We try to clean them up and make sure that they're not going to transport anything. This is our southern region facility. They got them a hot tub. I don't know if they turn it on or not, but... Mm-hmm. That's it.
Thank you, Darren. Questions by the rack?
I've got one. So was there anything changed in the management plan? Really, or is it just...
Yeah, some of the key things are using... So we used to have a transplant list. We're not required for beavers to have a list, but we wanted some criteria. And so what we're doing is we're using that BRAT model to assess whether it's suitable or not. The problem with the list is that it depended. I mean, some of the areas were really vague and others were really specific. This way, we can actually look at the habitat and decide what's appropriate. The other thing we changed is the old plan had some restrictions on subspecies and moving subspecies around the state. Everything that I can find indicates that North American beavers or North American beavers, there isn't any real strong evidence that those subspecies are real. Some people are lumpers and others are splitters. So we removed the restriction. So we don't, if you got animals in Box Elder County, it's okay to move them somewhere else. Essentially those are the main changes. What it's done is allow us a little bit more flexibility to do that.
Other questions, Brother Rack?
So, Darren, do you know, is there good evidence that beavers
can spread whirling disease or quagga mussels? Or is that just hypothetical?
Our aquatics folks want to be especially cautious. So
I get that.
I'm not familiar with any kind of data or studies, but we just, again, just wanted to err on the side of being cautious.
Other questions? Dr. Woodward, you're the only public. Do you have any questions?
I have none.
Right. I wore you out.
Come state your name.
All right, comments.
I'd just like to make the comment that there's good, you know, strong support from the Forest Service to incorporate this BRAT assessment into the beaver management plan.
Thank you.
Just a comment too with that, Joe. It's amazing on the forest up there, the remnants of old existing beaver ponds, and we must have a lot more water years ago. Maybe I don't know, but it's, you know, their habitat and their where they were. It's amazing, you know, that there was enough water ever there to create numerous deep beaver dams. You know,
I think they called that the Central Utah Water Project. To go that way.
Never mind.
Climate change.
Yeah. New discussion.
You know, they're on range.
All right. Other comments? We'll entertain a motion on this one.
I'll go ahead and motion that we accept the beaver management plan as presented.
Made by David. Do I have a second?
I'll second it.
Brad Horks on the second. Any discussion? All in favor? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Unanimous. Okay.
Appreciate everybody's time. That was a marathon.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, we tend to go long. We're kind of windy here.
They ask a lot of good questions and make a lot of good recommendations. I'm very impressed.
All right, I'll entertain a motion to adjourn.
I move we adjourn.
That was made by Joe Batty. David Gordon.
I think the Lions ate him.
Joe Batty made the motion. David Gordon made the second. And everybody was in favor.